Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
All right, and a very good morning across South Texas, the Hill Country, wherever you happen to be listening. And on the internet, well, who knows where you are, but I tell you, in our part of the world, it is another beautiful late spring morning and very comfortably cool out there. This Memorial Day weekend, it's, golly, just going to be beautiful weather to get out and enjoy, get some stuff done in the garden, hopefully get some relaxing in. That's what we're here to talk about for the next 3.5 hours. You know the number, 210-599-5555. I call this the Smart People's Half Hour. Anybody that's up early, if you have a question, may take a little bit more time to answer. We can spend a little bit more time getting into some of the many different subjects, or if you just want to get your question asked and get on your way this busy weekend, you know the number, 210-599-5555. Looks like Mary and Susan are going to be our first two callers, but that leaves a couple of lines open, and gosh, so much to talk about, but most important thing to me is what is on your mind. So, Jimmy, why don't we just get started with phone calls early? Mary's first in line. Good morning, Mary.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm the Florida Mary.
Yes, ma'am.
And I'm having trouble with my sun patience and the fungus. And I know you mentioned the difference between vinca and impatience one, but do we still use cornmeal?
Yes, cornmeal. Cornmeal isn't the magic. It's a beneficial fungus called Trichoderma, which grows on the cornmeal, and it will take care of everything from toenail fungus to athlete's foot to ringworm to just about anything that could hit plants. It's just gotten to be, with me, a standard that whenever I get ready to plant flower beds, whether it's flowers or vegetables, I will dust it pretty heavily with cornmeal first, and things that are especially susceptible at the time I plant them, I'll throw a little bit more on the soil. After things are up and growing, if problems start to develop, I'll just soak some whole ground cornmeal in water and use that to either drench or spray the plants. And it works pretty much across the board on most all fungal problems. So there are a few bacterial problems out there that I don't think that's what's going to bother the sun patients, but there are some bacterial things, in which case we usually make a direct application of cinnamon to the plants that seem to be affected. But most fungal problems, the Trichoderma will that grows on the cornmeal will certainly knock them out.
Yeah, it just seems like right at the base of the plant, you know, it just gets that white, moldy-looking.
Oh, yeah. And it just rots off right at ground level.
And it rots right off, right? Yeah, just
yeah, same thing, yeah. Begonias do. A couple of other things that are going to help with any kind of fungal issue, regardless of what the plants are, is if possible, when you're watering, just lay the hose on the ground. Try not to water from overhead. That really encourages a lot of different things. Are these in flower beds or are they in pots?
Pots, yeah.
Okay. Pots. Yeah, I would make it a point to, you know, at this point, I'd probably dust the soil around the base of them pretty heavily with cornmeal, and then next time they need water, I'd make up some of what we call the corn water tea, just cornmeal soaked in water, makes up some of that and use it to water the plants next time they need water, and it should go a long way toward controlling the problem.
Okay, now, so how much cornmeal would I put in a bucket of water, let's say?
You know, if you had a 5-gallon bucket, you'd put a cup or two.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I haven't done that, so that's a good idea. And then you can just keep that. I mean, that can just sit in the garage a while until it's time to water again.
Not too long, or it'll get kind of smelly. We don't want to make any of the old corn mash whiskey or anything like that. In fact, when we're baiting a trap for wild hogs, that's what we usually do, is let it sit for 2 or 3 days, and it becomes pretty aromatic, shall we say. So, I wouldn't make up more than you need, or you may be thinking something died in your garage and you can't find it. So, try to make it, give it about 24 hours at least, or overnight at least, to soak.
Overnight.
But, don't try to save it too long, or you'll be in the moonshine business, like it or not.
Okay. All right. Well, and then I have something else here that I'm not sure I can even tell you what it is. It was quite some time ago, and you and Howard were talking about putting something around trees, and it was dwarf organopond, something like that, and I don't know what that is.
Probably dwarf mondo, M-O-N-D-O, dwarf mondo grass.
What we commonly call
monkey grass, but there is a wonderful dwarf form of it. Ophiopogon is what it is botanically. There's a dwarf form that doesn't grow but about 2 inches tall, gets incredibly thick and dense, has virtually no problems. It'll grow in the shade extremely well if you plant it in the sun. It needs to be in pretty good soil, but you guys have a magical sun somehow in Florida. You guys can grow things in bright sun that would burn up here. I mean, I've flown through Miami a number of times, and you see, beds of regular impatiens out in the full sun, and occasionally get down there to a nurseryman's meeting. But I'm always surprised at the things that would burn up in Texas that seem to tolerate your sun relatively well. So I suspect the dwarf mondo would do fine in the sun for you as well, but I know it does well in the shade.
Okay, all right, so that'll help. Well, I'll tell you, I have an awful lot of shade now because I'm a tree person. Not very many of us have, they're cutting their trees down so they don't have to rake the leaves and all that kind of thing. But so when I do have sun, it's the direct right over the top, 2 or 3 hours. So.
Yeah.
That's my challenge. I just don't know what to even plant anymore.
If you're looking for a good ground cover, I would give it a try. It's not real fast to spread and fill in. It's kind of like regular monkey grass or the different forms of Liriope, Liriope, however you want to pronounce it. Is they take a little while to get started, but then they spread and they do extremely well. They're just not real fast. And the mondo is the same way. Dwarf mondo or regular mondo grass are the same way. You would plant your individual plants. If you're looking to create a solid ground cover, you'd plant them no more than a foot apart, and it'd probably take them 2 or 3 years to fill in. You can plant them closer if you like. It just gets expensive.
Yeah, right. Okay, all right. Well, thank you so much. Love listening to you.
Well, I sure appreciate it. You have a wonderful day over in the Sunshine State, and we'll visit again, I'm sure. And, Jimmy, let's move on. We've got Susan waiting, and it'll be Andrew and Bill. So good morning, Susan.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
I have a question about our native Rebecca, brown-eyed Susan.
Uh-huh, right.
It grows along our road, and I've read in my wildflower book that there are two different species that Texas has, but regardless of which species it is a perennial. That's how it's listed in the book.
Uh-huh.
So, and it also says that you can transplant it into landscapes. So I want to give it a try. My understanding is that usually with perennials, you move them in the season opposite of their bloom, which would be
That's
fall.
Correct. Right.
However, this is an area where our county road crew mows.
Right.
And I know where it is right now because it's in bloom. In fact, they knocked it over.
Sure.
So really the only thing I can do is try it now, and because I'm not going to be able to find it later.
Right. And I think you'll probably be okay. Water them in with some Garrett juice or a little bit of Super Thrive. And, as long as you get a reasonable portion of the root system, they will grow, and they will produce seed as well. There are lots and lots of different Rebeckias. There are a lot of so-called improved varieties out there. And if you're looking for anything other than just a wildflower meadow look, I think you might want to choose one of the, you know, one of the improved forms. There's one called Goldstrum, G-O-L-D-S-T-R-U-M, that is extremely good and perennial, you know, 19 years out of 20. There's several different ones out there, and they are very, very worth growing. They don't have a super long season of bloom, but they're, again, just a bright spot, and virtually nothing bothers them.
Bright, bright spot, meaning the most full sun I can give it?
Well, yes, they need a bright spot. The more sun they get, but what I'm meaning is they're just so colorful. They are a real bright spot in the landscape, but to bloom well, they need virtually full sun.
Okay. I've been in my previous property, I had Goldstrum going for years.
Mm-hmm.
At this place, I planted it three times and it died out on me.
Mm.
So it's the sunniest spot that I have in my bed.
Mm-hmm.
I think the issue probably was, since I've got it on drip irrigation, I probably didn't have my water turned on often enough or long enough for the plant to thrive through our beastly heat.
Oh, well, and hopefully we're moving back toward El Nino, and summers will be a little bit milder, but Rebeckia is pretty tolerant of drought when it is well established, but it can take months to really get those roots down and spread out. So, yeah, if it got neglected on the water end of it, July, August time, it probably said, no, thank you, I'm not going to do this, and... But it's once you get it established, I think you'll find it will be extremely hardy.
All right. And thank you so much.
You're certainly welcome. I appreciate the call this morning. Thank you. Next in line is Andrew. Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning, Bob.
Morning,
hey,
sir.
Quick question. I just got some sod laid down on my yard. And in the process of getting quotes from different landscape companies, one of the guys had mentioned... or recommended to throw some, like, of the granules for the grubs and whatnot. And he mentioned, like, once you throw it down, they tend to start coming up for brand new sod, depending on, you know, where these grass farms get their, or where they get their grass or whatnot.
Right.
And so I wanted to get your expertise on, is that something you recommend? If so, how far after the sod has been already established?
Well, the two mistakes that people make planting sod, number one, they go by the old adage of let it stay in there a month before you fertilize it. I totally disagree with that with organic fertilizers. I would either put some fertilizer down first, or if your grass is already in place, go ahead and fertilize it immediately. Organic fertilizers do not burn, and it will really help the grass get a good root system down. The grubs don't come, you know, they're you may have grub worms in the soil, but anything that's in the soil is going to be big old grubs that are well beyond their feeding stage. The part of the grub worm life cycle that does all the damage to our grasses are tiny little grubs that are called the first and second larval instars. And of course, where they come from is, you know, June bugs flying and laying the eggs. Now, that's not to say that they don't have, you know, June bugs, they don't get some eggs laid at the commercial grass farms, but most of those guys tend to be using so much poisons out there. I can't say that I've ever really seen sod come in with much of an established grub worm problem. People that are telling you to put down granules and things, number one, they're probably using a toxic product which may or may not work, and number two, they're probably just trying to sell you something. If I were concerned about grubs, I would treat with beneficial nematodes, which will take care of fire ants, which will take care of fleas, which will take care of a lot of other things without hurting earthworms and the good guys out there. So, again, the choice is yours. They're not real expensive, and it certainly you're not just only controlling grubs. Like I say, you're controlling a number of other things. So it certainly wouldn't be a bad idea. Is it mandatory? No, I don't think so, but I very definitely would feed. Did the company that installed the sod, did they roll it? Did they take a heavy water-fillable roller and roll the grass after they put it down?
Yes, sir.
Okay, very good.
Yeah.
And what kind of sod did you plant?
I think it's palmetto.
Palmetto? Okay, very good. That's one of the really good St. Augustines for shade. Fertilize it, whether or not you treat for grubs. I would keep an eye out for June bugs. A lot of folks will actually put out a June bug trap, which is simply a 5-gallon bucket with some soapy water in it, and then a light bulb up above. You can use one of those clip-on reflector lights, or you can simply dangle a bare bulb above it, and this draws in the adult June bugs. They bang into the light, drop down into the water, and drown. So it's not a bad idea if you have a place anywhere in your yard that you can put something like that out, and just check it every couple of days and see if you're getting June bugs in there. If so, then I would very definitely treat with beneficial nematodes.
Okay, well, where could I get that?
Just about any good nursery is going to carry them. There's been a little bit of a shortage. The company changed hands. They moved from Colorado to Oregon, and they simply haven't gotten their supply ramped up quite the way they need to. But whereas we used to get 2 shipments a week, they now send us about 1 shipment every 2 weeks. But look around, and I think you'll find them. They're totally safe for people and pets, and like I say, they take care of a number of other problems in the landscape. So not a bad idea to put out. And like I say, I doubt that your sod came in with grub worms, but they call them June bugs because they typically are out and about in June. They don't wait till June. We've seen them this year. We've seen them as early as March, and we see them sometimes as late as August. So it's a good idea to kind of monitor and be aware of when they're out there laying eggs.
Okay. And then just to follow up, you said natural fertilizer you would recommend doing.
Yeah.
Medina
makes a good one they call Growing Green. Maestro Grow makes a good product they call Texas Tea, T-E-E. Nature's Creation makes a good one they simply call Premium Lawn and Garden Food. Those are all based on different organic materials, but they're all very good fertilizers. Even though the numbers are lower on the bag, your plants get 100% of the fertilizer. Virtually nothing washes away. When you look at some of these synthetic products that have much higher nitrogen levels, especially much higher first number, that nitrogen is in a different form, and your plants are lucky to get 10% of it. So don't avoid the natural and organic products because the numbers are much lower. In truth, your plants get more out of those low number fertilizers than they do out of the high number. And sometime, if you're interested, we'll have a discussion about cation exchange capacity, which is how they do it. But Medina, Maestro Grow, Nature's Creation, all three of those companies make a real good product. So I probably shop for price and availability.
Thank you very much, Bob. You have a good morning.
You do the same, Andrew. I appreciate the call. Thank you, sir. And let's get Bill in here before the news break. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, sir. I've got two questions and a comment.
All right.
I'm going to quit listening to you and Howard Garrett. You talked about, and probably get me in trouble with my wife, too, but okay. You talked about top dressing the yard with compost.
Right.
And my wife urged me, and I did it here a while back.
Yeah.
Now I lay in the morning in bed, and I can hear it outside laughing, saying, ha, 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 you got to cut me again.
Well, guilty as charged. You sound like an old banker I had one time, and who used to call me, and Jim would say, "Webster, would you kindly shut up?" Because every Saturday morning, my mother calls me and says, "Jim, Bob said it's time to do such and such." So, yeah, but I like to think of it as I'm improving your health by giving you more exercise and keeping that grass mowed and everything else. But no, compost is it's just magic for grass. Yes, sir.
Okay, I'll get to my question. I just bought this home a year ago, a little over.
Congratulations.
It's got some type of Bermuda grass. It's not common Bermuda, but it's a pretty green grass.
Okay.
And I've got area in the backyard. They never really did anything to the backyard. I'm in Lavernia.
Okay.
Sandy soil.
Yeah.
The part that's in the sun, I'll try to duplicate this Bermuda and put it back there.
Mm-hmm.
But I got a lot of oak trees, and I've got a couple of real big ones that are shaded and nothing will grow. What's a good grass to go into there, or can I put a grass under those trees?
You can certainly put the only grass that's going to thrive in the shade will be one of your varieties of St. Augustine. There's a variety called Palmetto. There's another variety called Del Mar. Those are the two best St. Augustines for shade. Now, I've seen areas that were too shady for even St. Augustine to grow, and I recommend many times ground covers like Asiatic Jasmine or Vinca Minor or various things like that, because they don't take as much water. They don't have to be mowed. They're much lower maintenance. So out in your sunny areas, I would just go out in your front yard that looks so beautiful and just dig up some little plugs, 2-3 inches in diameter, and just plant those out in the sun. That way you're not spending any money and you get a little bit more exercise. But in the shade, it's either going to be ground cover or one of the shade-tolerant St. Augustine varieties.
Sounds good. Now, I'm probably pronouncing this wrong. A sago palm, a little short palm.
Yeah, sago palms, they're a cycad, yeah.
Back when we had our little freeze this year, some of the leaves, I guess that's what you call those, hanging on there.
You can call them leaves, you can call them fronds, either way, yeah.
Okay, they got burned on the ends. I thought they would die and fall or drop down, but the ends are brown.
Sure.
Back near the trunk of it is still green. Do I cut those off?
It'll look nicer. The plant doesn't really care. It's like cutting your hair or cutting your fingernails. Plant could care less. That's dead tissue. And it will it'll probably make other family members happier if you do trim them off. Has your sago put on a set of new fronds this spring yet?
Oh yes. Oh yeah.
Okay.
The top of it has exploded.
Yeah. Well, you can cut off as much as you like. The plant will be happiest if you only cut off the brown dead part of it. But if that's hard to do, if some of those older fronds are sort of half brown, half green, and you want to go ahead and cut them back all the way, you've got all this new growth coming out, which is going to kind of take over. So if you want to do the best thing, just, put on your gloves, because they are well armed. They've got some pretty big spines on there, but get in there and just trim out the parts that are brown. If you get some of those fronds that there's just too much brown on there, you're going to spend an hour trying to clean up one frond. Just go ahead and snip the whole thing off, because that new growth is going to be all you're going to see pretty soon.
Okay. Sounds like a winner. I'll see if I can forgive you for having me put that stuff on my yard.
Well,
you did a miracle.
It really is good. So you just remember that every time your neighbors compliment you and people start stopping and asking why your yard looks so good and theirs looks so bad, you can look real good and just tell them what they can do. But now, you also did the right thing, Bill, in putting your compost on while it was still a little cool. Our weather has been very moderate this spring, I'm happy to say, but once it really gets hot, Probably best to put off adding more compost until fall, because it's not going to kill anything, but the compost can produce temporary yellowing if you put it on once those daytime temperatures are up in the 90s or even upper 80s. And so far we've been blessed with a very mild spring, and I certainly hope that continues a while longer. But tell them what you've done, but if it gets real hot, tell them to wait till fall to do the same thing.
Sounds good. I just got a brand new neighbor, and he's already told me if I look up and see spotches in my yard gone, don't look in his yard.
A neighbor with a sense of humor. That's what we all need.
Well, you might as well laugh about it, Bob, because you can't do anything else.
Well, that's the way I look at life in general. And, it's kind of like politics and everything else. Somebody told me something the other day. He said, you know what the problem with political jokes is? And the answer is that too often they get elected. So you keep smiling and you get out and have a wonderful Memorial Day. And remember what we're honoring with all the men and women that gave their lives so that you and I could sit here and laugh about it and get out and work in our yards in peace and freedom. So very important time, and it's always good to hear from you. Anything else I can help you with today?
That ought to do it, Bob, and I agree with you completely. And you have a great one.
Thank you, sir. It's actually one of 7 days a year that we close. I don't know about Fanex. I know among my sponsors, I know Rhonda's going to be closed on Memorial Day. And a lot of folks do close on Memorial Day, including us at Shades of Green, because really is a holiday to remember. We celebrate the lives and what they've done for us. So I know you feel the same way, so you get out and enjoy. I've just got less than 30 seconds here before news, so I will tell you we do have some open lines. If you've been getting a busy signal, it's a good time to dial 210-599-5555. We'll get you up pretty quickly after the news. Speaking of our troops, our Operation Interdependence is going on now. It goes on through the 4th of July, where KTSA collects needed items for our troops around the world. You can go to KTSA.com, check out our website for all the information on that. I'll be back with you right after news here on KTSA Radio.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
All right, we do have a couple of lines open. Looks like we are going to talk to Bill and Carolyn and Teresa. That leaves one there for you to grab at 210-599-5555. Backing up to Operation Interdependence for just a moment, I might mention that it is co-sponsored by Kitchen Designs by Giovanni. And virtually all of our sponsors are drop-off locations. Like I say, go to KTSA.com to get all the information you need. And this will be up through the 4th of July, another good holiday to celebrate that KTSA will be collecting items for our troops all around the world. Another very, very good program. Let's just get right back to gardening here. And looks like Bill is up first. Good morning, Bill.
No, Carolyn's up.
Or
Bill.
Carolyn's next. I'm sorry. Read my note wrong here. Carolyn's next in line. Good morning, Carolyn.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, I have a few questions. My tomatoes are not making. I have an early girl that's making tomatoes. All of the plants are just absolutely gorgeous, 4 and 5 feet tall, okay? Mm-hmm. Last year I had so many tomatoes that I was giving them away, preserving them, doing everything. And I just I don't see any flowers on the tomatoes. I just, they're just not flowering.
And are they out in full sun?
Yes, they are much of the day anyway, most of the day. I plant them in the same place I always do. But some days we don't have any sun,
Right. And that's the only two things that really will keep tomatoes from flowering are not enough sun and not enough nutrient. Now, getting them to set fruit is, sometimes a different matter that's based on temperature, among other things, and to some extent flowering. You're my friend up in the Fort Worth area, aren't you?
Right.
Yeah, you You know, we've had wonderful, cool mornings, and this may be what's holding them back. I would very definitely be feeding, maybe even on a weekly basis, with one of the good liquid fertilizers, Has to Grow Plant or Medina's Fish Blend or one of the other good products. But other than that, I'll just tell you, we sometimes have to be patient, and cool nights could be retarding them a bit. I'm certainly not going to complain about these evenings in the 50s and 60s, and that may very well be what is keeping them from blooming well. But if you've got good sun and got good nutrition, they will bloom when they are ready to bloom. So be patient, increase your fertilizing, and when you start complaining about the heat, your tomatoes will probably be blooming and setting fruit like mad.
Okay, I hope so, because I've never had this problem before. So
right.
Okay, I'll try. I have been fertilizing them. I've been spraying with seaweed and molasses, doing the whole thing. So
very good.
I'll try more fertilizer. The other is my squash. Also a problem. The stink bugs have literally destroyed it. My squash was big enough to inject, which I did. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden it started declining. When one leaf would turn yellow, another leaf would turn yellow. I looked underneath it, and there were stink bugs everywhere.
Yeah.
So I got rid of them. I looked online, and there were several things. I tried to call last week, but I couldn't get in. And I didn't get neem oil, but I got I put soapy water, and it said to put that and spray it, and garlic, and I've done the garlic and the soapy water, and got picked off all the little brown beads off the back, all the, you know.
The eggs, yeah.
The eggs. And but I just finally had to pull up the squash, so I got to start it all over again, because it's just not,
You have plenty of time to plant more squash. Yeah, it's a good time to plant more squash. You will notice, and that's what I do, is go through and everywhere, you know, usually be between the big ribs on the back of the leaf where they lay those little brown eggs in a big cluster.
Right.
And I just take my fingernail and gouge that out and, you know, dump it in a little thing of soapy water. And if you miss some of them and they hatch, they make that little gray insect that moves around pretty quickly. Spinosad works extremely well at killing those. Now, the adult, they're really squash bugs rather than stink bugs. Once the adults get there, the thumb and forefinger are about the only thing that works on them. But when they're small, spinosad will get them very, very well. I would spray late in the day so that you're not bothering the bees. I'd also be a little careful about using garlic, but garlic can be pretty repellent to the bees. But if you're spraying in the late afternoon or evening, garlic is a preventive, spinosad is a curative, will really kill those guys out before they become adults.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I'll try that, but I didn't use the garlic but once, but by then it was probably too late anyway.
Right.
And, I just have to pull it out there. It had already gotten big enough to where I could inject it, but that wasn't the problem. Then the other question on squash is, which varieties do I not have to inject? Because I have planted some spaghetti squash. It seems to have now that one I planted way over somewhere near something, not even in the garden.
Right.
On the side of the house. And that one and the tatumi don't seem to have very big stems.
Right. The tatumi is the one that is most like our other summer squash, most like zucchinis. And they, you know, they are pretty much all too small stem for the vine borers to get in. Most of the so-called winter squash, I prefer to call them long-season squash, like spaghetti, like acorn, like, all the different ones that are really the Hubbard squash. The list just goes on and on. They don't grow in the winter. People call them winter squash because it's late in the season. They take much longer to produce. But virtually all of those have a smaller, tougher stem that the vine borers don't go after. And like I say, the thing that is most like our zucchinis and other summer squash is going to be the tatumi, what some people call calabacita.
Yeah, so I've got that in the spaghetti, so I don't need to inject it. But no. I did get a squash borer on one of my tatumis a couple of years ago. I did get one. So I usually, you know, you can't inject them very well, though, because they are such small stems.
Yeah, you want to avoid injecting your fingers in the process. But and do you know, I'm sure, what the moth that lays the eggs for the squash vine borer looks like?
It's the little orange thing that, yeah, you see it flying around.
And by all means, do everything you can to eliminate those. I tend to try to knock them down with a stream of water and then apply a foot to them. I even have somewhere from years ago have an old-fashioned butterfly net, and I probably look like a crazy man out there in the garden sometimes, but I try to eliminate every one of those moths I see because it seems like they show up a day or two before they start laying eggs, and you just want to do everything you can to head off the vine borers.
Yeah, well, they're hard to catch. That's all I can say.
Yeah, you can be.
This is like cucumber beetles. They fly fast. Yeah.
Yes, they do.
Okay, the other thing is I have something, you know, my cauliflower. I have a summer cauliflower that I planted last year, and it made.
Uh-huh.
So I planted it again, and the leaves look like Swiss cheese. And when I check, you know, during the day, there's the little caterpillar on there.
Right, right.
It's a little green caterpillar. But those leaves are so slick, even if I spray, the spray doesn't stick to them. You know, I've sprayed several times, but it doesn't stick. It just rolls right off of them.
Add a little molasses to it and maybe add a little bit of soap to it. It's hard to get things that really stick, but a little bit of molasses will help. It'll also make your BT much more effective, and that's what you should be spraying with.
I do.
And, add a little molasses and add just a little bit of soap to it, and I think you'll find it'll stick better for you.
Okay. And the Swiss chard has big chunks of leaves, has holes in it. And mm-hmm. I put the the granules around, and
right.
I have sprayed it also with the BT and the molasses, but something, and it looks almost like a grasshopper is eating big chunks of it off, but I don't see any grasshoppers. I haven't seen any grasshoppers.
Mm-hmm. It is usually a caterpillar on Swiss chard, mm-hmm. As well, on chard and on kale for that matter, but it's probably a big black fuzzy caterpillar they call a woolly bear. And I don't know how they hide so effectively during the day. They're out almost exclusively at night. And if you're ever, you know, up with a flashlight after it gets dark, do your spraying then, and you'll most likely get some of the product on them, and that'll be the end of them.
Okay, because it's not getting them, you know. I just sprayed, I picked all the Swiss chard, and then I sprayed. And of course, you have to spray often because the chard grows so fast.
Exactly. You know, so. That's the thing, though, about adding a little molasses to the spray. It really seems to make it last longer. And I like molasses and seaweed just as a general maintenance spray through the warm weather. And I have found that on tomatoes, because, you know, the hornworms are the big caterpillar we have a problem with there. But I found that by using BT early in the season and then spraying somewhat regularly with the seaweed molasses spray, the BT pretty much seems to remain effective throughout the summer months. I rarely have to apply it a second time. So, and of course, you know, the molasses and seaweed combination does worlds to stop spider mites from becoming a problem. But
sure.
that molasses is a very strong bacterial stimulant. And that, of course, is what BT is a bacterium. And so spraying with that will keep your BT active for a much longer period of time.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Great questions. And thank you for the call this morning, Carolyn. You have a wonderful Memorial Day in North Texas for us. Thank you kindly.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Teresa, hang on just a second. You will be up in, you'll be up next. But right now, I need to take a moment and talk about the Window Source of San Antonio, which is always a pleasure. You know, Moses and his staff are really out there to provide a new level of service and quality in the window industry. And they're, if you're thinking of upgrading with low-E windows, with a better-looking window, with vinyl windows, it just, I hope you'll consider the Window Source when you're getting bids on your project, because you're going to find they have top-quality windows, most of them made right here in Texas, or doors as well. Their workmanship is outstanding, and they give you a warranty that really does cover all the potential problems, including labor and glass breakage. Very few companies have that in their warranties. You always have to read the fine print. Well, with Window Source, there's really not any fine print to read. It's just if anything goes wrong, we'll come out and take care of it. They have very attractive windows. They have run some introductory specials. You just have to talk to Moses to see if they've got anything special going on right now. They welcome you to visit their showroom, which is around in Southwest San Antonio. And like I say, I think you'll find that they have a very good reputation, and they're just really, really out there to please you. So when you're considering that big window product, be sure that they are among the folks to give you a bid. I think you'll find they're great people to do business with. If you'd like to give them a call, they always welcome that. 210-879-4433, 879-4433 for the Window Source of San Antonio.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening. It's going to be Teresa and Scott and Terry. One line open. Grab it if you like. 210-599-5555. I say good morning, Teresa.
Good morning, Bob. How are you?
I'm off to a good start. It's an absolutely gorgeous morning out there once again.
Yes, it is. I just have a few quick questions. When I'm making a garlic pepper spray, can I add Medina products to it also, like the liquid fish?
Yeah. Yeah, no problem at all with that.
Okay, what about if I made a spinosad solution or compost tea? Can I add more of that to it?
Yes, you certainly can. I would not add any peroxide. Some people like using hydrogen peroxide for a number of different problems, but it is very definitely antimicrobial. But as far as adding, you know, things like molasses, seaweed, fish meal, or liquid fish, things like that, yeah, go ahead and, you know, make as much of a cocktail as you like, kind of like Howard Garrett did with the original Garrett juice formulation. It's not all about one thing. It's just make a good mix and put it out there. The only negatives, of course, is if you're spraying flowers, anything that has molasses, anything that has much humate material in it is going to leave a brown stain on white flowers, but other than that, your plants will love you for it.
Great. Okay, and on tomatoes, I've not been a tomato grower, but I am this year, and they're doing wonderful.
Good.
A couple of weeks ago, I did water them with some of the Epsom salt solution. How often should I do that?
Generally speaking, what I do is I put dry Epsom salts down at the time I plant, and that pretty much carries them through the whole summer. So if you've done your solution 2 tablespoons per gallon, you do that once or twice, that's probably going to get you through the whole summer. Remember, what you're doing is you're not wanting the plants to take up the things in Epsom salts. What you're doing is changing the balance of calcium and magnesium in the soil. You're actually improving the soil. This is not something that, you know, the plant itself benefits from other than indirectly, because all of a sudden the soil contains more readily available nutrient material. So generally speaking, it's not something that you have to do over and over. Once you get your soil in good shape, you're good till the next season.
Okay. And you had a previous caller, she said her tomatoes weren't flowering, and you told her to fertilize more. Were you wanting her to, is that foliar spray or in the ground?
Yes.
Both.
I don't believe in overdoing foliar spraying, because sometimes the plants will tend to put on vegetative growth at the expense of not developing as much roots. But in the average vegetable garden, an occasional foliar spray is just fine. I go back, you know, I've grown orchids most of my life, ever since the eighth grade. And I have a friend that, I don't know if Rob's still with USDA or not, but they did a lot of experiments, and they found, and some other countries, Taiwan in particular, and they're one of the big suppliers that you're seeing all these Phalaenopsis orchids in all the grocery stores and everywhere, but they use almost exclusively foliar sprays, and most of their plants have a cruddy root system. At the time we were growing them commercially, the people we were selling to, which were various nurseries, they told us that our plants had a shelf life that were four times as long as anybody else's, because we focused on building a good root system. And I think that's true of any plant you want to pick. If you give the plants everything they need through the leaves, they just really don't have that reason to grow a real expensive or extensive widespread root system. So I do like an occasional foliar feeding. I think it's just, it gets things into the plant more quickly. But, boy, don't do it at the expense of, you know, your good old ground soaking, because that long-term is where your plants should get most of their nutrients.
Okay, that makes sense. And I've heard you talk about spraying your tomato plants with the BT and molasses. I've just pulled off about 6 hornworms a couple of weeks ago. I haven't seen any more since.
Right.
And I heard you talk about the BT. Is it too late to spray that on there?
Never too late to spray that on there. Just, you know, be very circumspect about where you put it. Don't go out and spray your whole landscape, but anything that is susceptible to caterpillars, and that's going to include tomatoes and peppers and eggplant, yes, I would very definitely be doing that. If you're growing Swiss chard, which is one of our few leafy things we grow in the summer, spray that as well. It's pretty much, I think, a waste of time on things like okra, which get the occasional caterpillar, but doesn't seem to be much of a detriment to the plants. I'd watch your cucumbers, watch your squash. If you start seeing the fecal pellets, or if you start seeing big pieces of leaves disappear, you can certainly spray it, but I wouldn't get carried away there. It's mainly peppers, tomatoes, eggplant, and any leafy greens that you're growing, that those are the main things you want to be spraying regularly.
Okay. And you add a couple of tablespoons of molasses to that, right, per gallon?
Add about a tablespoon per gallon.
Okay, tablespoon. Okay, Bob, I sure appreciate it. Thank you so
well,
much.
Well, I appreciate you. You get out and have a wonderful Memorial Day weekend, Teresa. It's good to hear from you.
Thank you so much, Bob.
You're
bye.
Welcome. Goodbye. All right, next in line is Scott. Good morning, Scott.
Hello, how are you doing, Bob?
I'm doing well. How about yourself?
I'm doing all right. I've got a question about some crepe myrtles.
Yes, sir.
I've got probably 10 or 12 on my property.
Uh-huh.
And 3 of them that are kind of in one corner of the property, I noticed the bark, I mean, really coming off of them.
Mm-hmm.
So I went over there and peeled some back, and it looks like almost like termite tunnels under the bark, but I can't see any insects. Is there some type of bark?
There,
crepe myrtle bark disease?
Not very common. I mean, it's perfectly normal for crepe myrtles to be shedding bark all the time. Occasionally, although it's rarely in crepe myrtles, peach trees and things like that, we have a little borer that will get under there and, you know, just kind of eat right underneath the bark. And I guess it's possible that you might have some of those on crepe myrtles. I've just never seen it. They're very easy to control, and you just mix up a solution of orange oil and water, spray it on the bark, and it goes right through the bark and, you know, kills whatever borers or anything are underneath it. How does the foliage on the crepe myrtles look? How does the growth look overall on all your crepe myrtles?
Well, out of all the crepe myrtles, those 3 are the ones that are like in a group kind of together.
Uh-huh.
And they look good. They're not, the foliage looks good, but, you know, I know the bark exfoliates.
Mm-hmm.
And it was excessive. That's why I went and looked at it, and I could peel it back, and there'd be like up the trunk, coming from the ground up the trunk, and then even further up, it's like a little collar of it poofing
uh-huh.
out, and I peeled it back, and you can kind of see a, looks like termite tunnel, yeah, but there's no insects. I can't
right
find
it. Our common subterranean termite, which fortunately is we rarely have the Formosan termites, which eat green wood, but our more common termites only eat dead wood, so
right,
not likely to be an issue there. Have you exposed the root flare on those crepe myrtles? Because most every crepe myrtle sold is buried too deep before you even put it in the ground, and then half the landscapers out there don't know what they're doing, and they plant them even deeper. So with all of those 10 crepe myrtles, if you haven't already done so, I would pull the soil back away from the trunk until you get down, not and just cut out any little fibrous roots you see, but you want to have the trunk exposed down to where those first major roots start developing. And if there's one plant that is almost 100% of the time planted too deeply, it's the crepe myrtle, and that will reduce the vigor, will reduce the blooming, and will make them more susceptible to things like borers and various other insects that might go after them otherwise. But a healthy crepe myrtle is just not going to have much of anything that bothers it. Some of the older varieties still pick up some powdery mildew when we have wet weather, but vigorous crepe myrtles ought to be withstanding just about everything. And but it's, like I say, about 100% of the crepe myrtles out there come to you already buried too deeply. So check that when you have a chance. If the plants seem to be vigorous, if they're blooming well, I wouldn't worry about too much else. If you feel like, and if you find more evidence that something is working underneath the bark, then make up a little bit stronger orange oil solution, maybe 4 ounces to a gallon of water. Spray that, just coating the bark with it, and it'll go directly through the bark and kill any insects that are underneath it doing any damage.
Right. Well, you can see the little squiggly tunnels and, like, sawdust in the tunnel. I guess they're right there in the cambium layer.
And that's where you, yeah, that's where you don't want them. It would be very unusual for it to be a termite, but if you got any deadwood in there, then it certainly could be. It could be carpenter ants, for that matter. But some beneficial nematodes at the, if it is termites, are they?
It's not termites. I know what termites okay look like, but it's looks like the tunnels they create. You know.
Yeah. I'll spray with some spinosad. Yeah,
very
mix up
small.
Your...
I was just worried it might girdle them at some point, you know.
And yeah, I would be concerned about that. But it certainly wouldn't hurt to spray, like I say, with a relatively strong orange oil solution, and that will take care of any insect that's causing damage underneath the bark. If you start seeing many ants around, because you can sometimes have carpenter ants in them, then spinosad is a product to go after those guys with, and very safe for you, very bad for the ants.
Right. All right. Well, thanks for your information.
Keep me posted on how they do. I'll look forward to hearing from you, Scott.
Okay. All right. I was wondering, maybe I'll send you a picture of them at some point, because it's
love
very
to...
unusual. I've never seen that before, and there's crepe myrtles here that have probably been here 50 or 60 years, and they don't have it, and those have been there 20.
I'm going to make a,
mm-hmm,
yeah, it's very unusual. I'm making a note as we speak to ask Howard Garrett if he's seen any of that up in the Dallas area, because that's very unusual. I'd love to see a picture of it when you have a chance, but most importantly, let's get rid of them so your crepe myrtles continue to thrive.
All right. Sounds good. Thanks for your help.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, sir.
Bye.
Bye. All right, let me get a break out of the way here. Terry will be up next, but it looks like I get to talk to you about nature's creation. And I was out, line trimmer, taking down weeds and things like that, and I will admit I picked up a couple of chiggers along the way. If you're fighting things like chiggers and just about any kind of insects in your grass around your yard, I want to tell you about a very effective repellent that you can use out there, and it's called Cedar Repel. You can get two different kinds. If you've just got a general area that you want to keep the fleas out of, say around dogs' bedding or something like that, you can get your Cedar Repel as granules. If you're wanting something you can spray, you can get the Cedar Repel liquid, and that's what an old friend used on the Little League fields that he was responsible for, and said his kids never had any problem with sugars, and I know that this is getting into the time of year when sugars can just drive you crazy if you get into a bunch of them. So if you have Bermuda grass, you're not going to have a problem with St. Augustine grass, but if you've got Bermuda grass or many of our native grasses and you are concerned about the insects, just get some Cedar Repel. It's a totally natural product. It's totally harmless to people and pets, but boy, does it work to keep away a lot of different insects, including mosquitoes. You're getting ready to have a party outside, spray the yard down with the Cedar Repel. It'll leave a very nice, pleasant fragrance, and it does not cause allergy problems. That's a whole different matter, but it sure will keep things like mosquitoes and gnats and flies away for quite some time. Cedar Repel is a natural product. The company that makes it is called Nature's Creation. They also make very fine compost products and mulch products, and they package a great cornmeal. They make great fertilizer. Nature's Creation is a good company with a lot of different quality natural products. Right now, they just want me to feature the Cedar Repel. You're going to find it at good nurseries all over the place. Both Rainbow Gardens locations carry it, Milburgers. Oh, up in the Hill Country, you'll find things at Hill Country, African Violets, Friendly Natives up in Fredericksburg, Plant House, both Kerrville and New Braunfels. And, of course, we keep their products here at Shades of Green. Quality products from our friends at Nature's Creation.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening and straight back to the phone lines. It's going to be Terry and Ron and Turkey Tom. Terry is up first. Good morning, Terry.
Good morning, Bob. First-time caller and a listener for a while, so thank you for what you do.
Well, I appreciate that, and I appreciate you calling.
All right, first question is, I have crepe myrtles also, but during the winter, I didn't think they were going to come back. So the shoots are coming up. Some of the branches aren't blooming. Do I cut back the whole branch or just up to where the leaves are coming out?
Really just anywhere that you have dead tips on the limbs, pretty much anything beyond where the leaves are coming out, that is how far you might as well take the dead growth off. Now, beyond that, crepe myrtles can be bushes or they can be trees, and you prune according to what you like. And it's just a matter of pruning shears. There are no varieties that are, you know, always trees, or no varieties that are always bushes. If you have limited space around them, sometimes pruning to be more tree-like is a good idea. If you want my grandmother used to call it a giant bouquet of flowers. There's a huge one on the property next to their flower shop. And so that's really up to you. I think sometimes it's good to thin them out just a little bit, but whatever you do, don't practice that Houstonians do that we tend to refer to as crepe murder, where they go through and just lop all the limbs back to a, you know, random point. That's a bad idea. But if you want to just cut off any limb that doesn't have leaves on it at this point is probably dead. So I begin by cutting off all the dead tissue, and then I'd go back and look and say, okay, to have a pretty plant, to have a good shape, what additional pruning do I want to do, and go after it. The crepe myrtles, how often they bloom, how early they start blooming is largely dependent on the variety you have, but all of them, you know, should be starting to come into bloom now. So you're just giving them a haircut. You're just making them look nicer is really all you're doing in pruning at this time of year.
Okay, good. And then my next question, I have the Oklahoma red buds, and every year, I've had them for 2 years, and it seems like I keep getting brown spots on the leaves, and I used neem oil last year, but what could be causing it to come back every year?
Again, neem oil you have to be careful with, because being an oil, it can burn, and it can create some brown spots on its own. typically with red buds, Oklahoma should not be having as many problems with that as a common Texas red bud, but it's usually a sign of excessive moisture. Once your red bud is in and established, you should virtually never, ever have to water it. And about the only thing I see killing red buds is too frequent watering. So water very thoroughly when you need to water, but if they've been in the ground 2 years, man, you ought to be able to not have to water more than once a month at the very most.
Okay, so that's what I'm doing then. You just answered my question. I'm
overwatering. Well, remember this. There really is no such thing as overwatering, but there is watering too often, and there's a big difference. Because when you water, you want to really water thoroughly, but you don't want to water again until the soil is dry. In the case of a red bud, an established red bud, several inches deep. Water doesn't hurt anything, but when the ground stays so saturated that the water drives the oxygen out of the soil, a plant's roots have to have oxygen. If they're staying too wet, oxygen's not there, the root hairs are going to die, the roots are going to die. And I see red buds killed every year from people literally killing them with kindness. So when you water, do a good job of it, but make it pretty infrequent.
Okay. Thank you so much, Bob. Have a great day.
Well, you do the same, and don't wait so long to call me again, Terry.
Thank you.
Always here for you. Thank you.
All right.
Goodbye. All right, Jimmy, let's see if Ron's ready to talk. Good morning, Ron.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
I want to thank you for everything you do and helping us in our gardening challenges.
Well, it's my great pleasure. My desire is to keep you from making all the mistakes that I've made over the years. So if I can do that, you'll become a pretty good gardener.
Well, good. So I have an invasive plant on my acreage, 10 acres. I think it's called horse nettle. It's got an attractive purple flower, mm-hmm. a seed pod about the size of cherry tomatoes.
Right.
And it's really spreading, I would say, in an invasive manner. What can I do?
What do you have a pasture grass in this, or is this just good old native hill country land? What kind of grass do you have?
Yeah, native hill country.
Okay.
Grass.
This time of year, about all you can do, because that stuff is just, it'll make you very uncomfortable as you get into it, as I'm sure you have discovered. Generally speaking, early in the year, it's one of the first things to sprout out before your native grasses really start greening up. And at that point, spraying with the orange oil and vinegar mixture will typically kill the small nettle plants. Beyond that, do you shred your acreage with any regularity, or too rocky, too many other plants?
I generally only do it once in, like, over the winter time, just to knock it down and give it the look. Otherwise, I try to keep things natural looking.
Yeah. Again, in the area that you're fighting the nettle, you may want to shred a little bit more often, cut fairly high, but it sure would be nice to keep the flowers and seed pods from developing too much on that. But your best control is going to be getting out before your native grasses really start greening up and spray in the areas where you have the worst nettle problems with just your standard vinegar and orange oil mix, 2 ounces of orange oil to a gallon of vinegar, and it won't hurt your native grasses at all while they're still dormant, but it'll knock out the nettle just as it starts its spring growth. And normally, most of these nettles are annual, so if you can kill them early, you're pretty much good all season long.
Oh, I thought they were perennials because they come back. I mean, it's like an underground runner.
And we may be talking about two different nettles. Are you sure that what you're not looking at is what we call nightshade, has kind of a gray-green leaf and then kind of a light purple flower?
Yeah, that may be it, because it does
okay.
have the underground runners.
Okay. If you're looking at nightshade, I tell you, they're... Even the toxic stuffs don't really touch that very well. About the only thing you're going to find is just to let your native grasses choke it out, maybe even a little bit of organic fertilizer periodically. But nightshade is just the bane of our existence in the hill country. And it's when we have a moist spring like we've had this spring, it's even worse. But that's known as nightshade, and you can spot spray with your orange oil and vinegar, and you'll really set it back. But man, I wish I could tell you a surefire solution to get rid of it, because I fight it. Every rancher, every farmer I know of fights it in the hill country.
Okay, it's called nightshade. All right.
Yeah, and try to mow it off, cut it off. You know, it makes those seed pods that once they start turning yellow, they're going to start throwing seed everywhere. So, you know, set that mower up high, and I was mowing for it just this week along with some other thistles out there. But it's tough to control. But try to keep it from reseeding. And do you run any stock on your grass?
I do not.
Okay. In that case, that's probably a good thing. But I'm afraid I'm going to have to suggest that you shred a little bit more often, but set it up high so you're not really knocking your native grasses down too much. But just keep cutting the top off the nightshade. You will reduce it. You'll probably never be rid of it, but don't be tempted by some of the broadleaf herbicides, because they'll harm your native grasses as well, and they're just not that effective on the nightshade.
All right. Thank you so much. I greatly appreciate it.
I wish I could give you a better answer, and I'll certainly let you know if we find one. Thank you, sir. Let's get our last break of the hour in here, and I get to talk to you about Morales Feed. Fred Morales is so godly. Fred has done so much to help farmers and ranchers in South Texas. And, of course, his business is known for quality feed, known for the K-Line irrigation, known for a lot of different fine products that they carry. But Fred is out there just always looking at ways to help people improve their land. And, of course, main thing we find in agricultural lands is a lack of organic material, because it's literally been burned out of the soil by years of improper management techniques and a lot of synthetic fertilizers. Well, Fred has come up with a good compost source, not something that I'd really recommend for your lawn or for your garden, but cheap enough to be able to use it on acreage. And of course, nothing builds organic material back as well as compost does. And Fred can even help you with the application if you need that. If you're looking to really improve your land without breaking the bank, you really need to talk to Fred. He's there at Morales Feed, always happy to help you. And just talk to him about his new acreage compost material. I think you'd be real glad you did. And if you don't know Fred already, you will make a very, very good friend in the process. It's Fred Morales with Morales Feed.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening. It's going to be Turkey Tom and Pam. Tom is up first. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Bob. How are you this morning?
It's just another beautiful morning out there. These mornings in the mid to upper 60s are sure a nice way to start a day.
Yes, sir. Beats the 80s that we'll get in a couple months.
Let's focus on the good stuff. I don't even want to think about August at this point. So what's going on in your world today?
Well, I got a couple questions for you. Every year I plant pumpkins, and I seem to have found a really vigorous variety of pumpkin to the point where I've had volunteer plants every year that 30, 40 feet long in just a couple of weeks. And I've tried growing watermelon, and I have not found a watermelon variety that's big-leafed and vigorous. Every one I've tried so far has had small little leaves and doesn't seem to want to grow that vigorously. Do you know any watermelon varieties that are just real vigorous producers?
Charleston Gray is probably the one. I haven't grown watermelons in years. They just take up too much room in the garden for not that much fruit. But Charleston Gray is probably one of the ones that I have seen most people be very successful with. What is your soil like? Is it sandy? Is it clay? What kind of soil do you have?
Well, actually, yes to both. The back of our property, I have got multiple gardens. The back is thick clay, but the front is thick sand. So the front is like 20 feet of sand. The back is about 20 feet of clay.
Okay. Well, the sandy area is where your watermelons are going to do best. And get them in pretty early in the season. And are you sure what you're looking at in your real vigorous vine is not a gourd, but is truly a pumpkin?
Oh, it's a pumpkin. I've already harvested them.
Oh, okay.
I probably put about 10 of them away just yesterday.
Well, there's no reason. Time. Yeah, no reason you shouldn't grow a good watermelon. And the other one that, you know, a lot of people like that is called Sugar Baby. And of the smaller, rounder melons, that has probably been the most vigorous. And like I say, they just take up too much room, and I fight too many weeds in gardening to grow anything that spreads out that much. But I'd look at Charleston Gray for a big variety. I'd look maybe at Sugar Baby for a smaller, rounder watermelon. And just be sure that you're watering super thoroughly when you water. Then let them go almost to the point of wilting, and then just another very thorough saturation again.
Yeah, Sugar Baby is one of the ones I planted this year, and it's just a small vine. It doesn't seem to be that vigorous, but
they
Charleston Gray a try.
Yeah, and they do like fertilizer, and especially in sand, you have very little cation exchange material there to hold the fertilizer in place, so. Until you get more organic material built up, and you can always go back and add some, some rock minerals, some things like lava sand and things like that. But be fertilizing fairly frequently. It's also been my observation that most melons, including watermelons, take a lot more fertilizer than pumpkins, and this may be why your pumpkins are doing so much better.
Well, that's good to know. I appreciate that. And with the same type of question, do you know a corn variety that's real vigorous, sweet corn?
Oh, golly. I fight the raccoon so much. I haven't grown much corn in the past couple of years. Let me get back to you on that. I don't really bring one to mind, but I'll take over the news break. Let me run look at our seed rack and see if I can pick out one that would be most likely to do really well for you.
Okay, I appreciate that. And one last question. We were talking about pruning peach trees last week, and that's on my agenda for tomorrow morning. Should I lop off the main trunk at the height that I'm going to prune it to, or should I leave that main trunk alone?
No. Take the main trunk out and try to leave 4 to 5 limbs radiating out like spokes of a wheel. And this is the only time you'll prune that severely. You'll thin in the winter months on a regular basis. But go ahead and cut that main trunk back so that you put the growth outwards. If you want to hang on, we can talk a little more. I've got to go to news here on KTSA Radio.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
All right, back to gardening, and looks like I've got 2 lines open. You'll get in line right behind Pam and Rosa. You just heard the number, 210-599-5555. We'll remind you, this is the tax-free weekend. They call it the Water Saver Weekend, but it applies to a lot of different things. But anywhere you shop for plants and gardening supplies, all plants are free of sales tax this weekend. All things like mulch and compost and soils, you'll pay no sales tax on those as well. You will not pay sales tax on drip irrigation or soaker hoses. I don't care for soaker hoses, but I do like the pressure compensated drip. Anyway, all this is sales tax free Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. So thinking about stocking up on compost or mulch, or if you've got some landscape planting to do, Never hurts to save about 8% on those plants. So keep in mind that's the state comptroller does not do a real good job of letting everybody know about this. So I won't promise you that every nursery is aware of it, but certainly point it out to them. You can go for more information online. But again, this tax-free weekend on plants, on compost, on mulch, and on drip irrigation, that sort of thing. I don't know why they feel like even house plants are water saving, but anyway, it includes all plants and all grass. So might save some money this weekend, or you will save some money if you're out buying any of those things. My next 2 callers are going to be Pam and Rosa, and Pam is first in line. Good morning, Pam.
Well, good morning, Bob. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
I live in New Braunfels on the east side of the freeway. So I'm not in the rocks. I'm in the clay, dirt thing.
Right.
bought my house about 10 years ago, had grass everywhere. It was nice. Over the years, I'm not really good at watering, and I feel like I really don't want to waste it on a French lawn. But now I've got a lot of mud spots, so I've put in winter rye. Like in the winter, I just threw out some stuff, and it does okay holding the dirt during the winter. But what do I do for the summer? Is there some kind of grass that doesn't need a whole lot of water that might grow?
Well, Bermuda is our most drought-tolerant grass. Now, you have to be real good about watering to get it started, and it's just now time that the Bermuda, it's really time to plant it because it doesn't like it warm. It likes it hot. But Bermuda is great in that if you want to keep it green, you have to water it, just like every other grass out there. But if you travel, I'm trying to be nice here. If you get a little neglectful of your yard, shall we say, the Bermuda will just turn brown and then it'll green back up when it gets water. Unlike St. Augustine, which if you get neglectful about it, it'll die on you. But Bermuda is probably, for a lawn grass, for a turf grass, is going to be by far the most drought tolerant. Like I say, it's not going to look beautiful if you don't water it, but once it's established, once it has gotten those roots down, then it can go for extended periods of time without water and still stay alive. So that is going to be the best of the lawn type grasses. Now, if you decide you want to go with just a native grass mix and not mow so often as well as not water so often, there are a number of grasses. Probably the best is a grass blend was developed up at the Wildflower Research Center in Austin called Habiturf. And it's a combination of curly mesquite and a couple of other native grasses. And it is probably going to be the most maintenance-free grass as far as mowing and watering that you could possibly plant. And it is planted from seed. So Habiturf, you're not going to make it ever look like a golf green or anything like that. Bermuda, you can mow and have a nice-looking yard, especially in a rainy season, if you're looking for a more manicured yard. But if you're just looking for, you know, more of a rural landscape, I guess you'd say, take a look at Habiturf. You'll probably get it from Douglas King Seed Company down here in San Antonio, but they will ship to your door. You don't have to. It's not a very long drive from New Braunfels, but if you want, Dean can ship it directly to you, and that's probably going to be your lowest maintenance long-term option. But like I say, it's not a grass you're going to mow and manicure, but it sure keeps a nice looking yard for you with very little maintenance and very little water on your part.
Okay, well, I'll look into that one. On the Bermuda, if that's what I can find in the area easier. Is that a seed, or is that when you go buy grass at like one of these box stores? I know I shouldn't, but that's not Bermuda, is it?
It depends on which box store, and they ought to stick to selling lumber. Bermuda can be planted from seed or from sod. Common Bermuda, cheap and easy to plant from seed. If you want one of really dense ones, one of the varieties we call TIFF, T-I-F-F, TIFF Green, TIFF Way, TIFF 419, these have to be planted from existing pieces of sod, and you will find people that sell the little plugs. But just old common Bermuda, you might as well just plant it from seed. There's some improved varieties. Once again, I'd send you to Douglas King for the better varieties. But if you're just looking for the cheapest, easiest way out, good old common Bermuda that you can buy seed almost anywhere is all you have to have. Now, again, it's not perfect. It's going to have chiggers in it. It's going to not be the prettiest lawn you've ever grown, but it's sure going to be the most drought-tolerant and most easy to maintain.
Oh, I came from Wimberley, so it was all rocks. So any kind of grass is an improvement.
Okay. Well, again, common Bermuda would be, if you want a mowable turf-type grass, that would be a good choice. If you want more of a lawn that you don't have to do much of anything to, look at Habiturf or look at some of the other native grasses.
All right. Thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
I appreciate the call. You get in and have a wonderful Memorial Day weekend. And
Thank you. I hope you do, too.
Thank you so much. Next in line is Rosa. Good morning, Rosa.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Let me see. I heard you talking about cedar repel.
Yes,
I was wondering, I know chiggers, but how about snakes, skunks, or spiders?
I doubt if it'll do anything against skunks. Snakes do not like it. There is nothing that's going to 100% guarantee that you're not going to have a snake come around. If I were trying to sneak snakes out of my flower beds and things like that, I'd probably go with a granular form of cedar repel, and it's about as good a snake repellent as you're going to find. But it will very definitely work at keeping them away. Skunks, I don't think anything's going to keep them away. And spiders, it may. I think the liquid against spiders, I think the liquid cedar repel would probably work better against them.
Oh, wow. Okay. My goodness, we're fighting all kinds of bugs today, aren't we?
Well, it's that season. You know, when the season's wonderful for people, when the weather's wonderful for people, it's wonderful for critters as well. So I guess we could all move to New Zealand if we didn't want to have snakes, but they do have their share of spiders and other things. But, yeah, it's just, I don't know, Mother Nature's diversity doesn't always agree with what we want, unfortunately.
I know, and I shouldn't even complain. But how about caterpillars? I've been seeing these white ones, woolly ones and black ones across the driveway, and I've just been smashing them. But
well, that's the most effective control. Now, if you want a spray that if it comes in contact with them, it kills them, spinosad will do a good job of that. In a targeted area, we sometimes use the BT in a flower garden or a vegetable garden where the caterpillars are a problem. I never just make a broad spectrum spraying with it, though, because if we killed off all the caterpillars, we wouldn't have the beautiful butterflies. But where, you know, if you've got, you know, tomatoes or something like that and you want to keep the hornworms at bay, you can mix up a little BT, but don't spray anything except your tomatoes with that.
Oh, okay. Well, okay, here we go. Going to go into a big fight here, and we'll see.
Well, just be, you know, caterpillars eat plants. It's just how much damage are you willing to tolerate? Some caterpillars, especially butterfly larvae, sometimes they target very specific plants. There's a little plant called the grove fritillary, and about the only thing their caterpillars eat is passion vine. And then there are things like the beautiful black...
Oh, I have tons of passion vine. Oh.
Well, just keep an eye out for these little orange and black caterpillars, and if they show up, let them have a little bit of it, and you pick them off the rest of it. There's a beautiful caterpillar or beautiful butterfly called the, I believe it's called the black monarch, and it always lays its eggs on fennel or rue or parsley. Those are about the only things that their caterpillars eat, so... you can, if you're wanting to encourage certain butterflies, you can plant certain plants that will attract their larvae as well as the adults. But just, yeah, across the board, just be selective in your spraying. Anywhere you have a problem, spray there, but leave the rest of your landscape alone.
Okay, dokie. Gonna try it. Thank you so much. You have a great day.
Thank you so much. And you get out and enjoy your beautiful Memorial Day weekend, Rosa. It's always good to talk to you.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
You're welcome. Goodbye. All right, let's see here. I need to get a break in. Clint, you're up next, and it'll be Robin. Right now, though, I get to talk to you about Southwest Metal Roofing Systems, and I love talking about Southwest Metal Roofing Systems because they give you peace of mind when it comes to your roofs. You hear a lot of roofing ads and a lot of talk about, oh, the sun's hurt your roof, the cold has hurt your roof, the hail beat your roof up. If you have a Southwest Metal Roofing Systems roof on your home like I do, you don't worry about weather. We have one of the roofs on our Shades of Green nursery. They're just the best roofs I have ever seen. Ours have stood up to big hail, stood up to all kinds of wind. They just have the most durable metal out there, and their workmanship just second to none. If you're looking for a lifetime roof, do what Danny Bowes over at Southwest Metal Roofing says. Do it once, do it for life. That's what Southwest Metal Roofing Systems roofs will do for you. That's why they give the best warranty in the industry, because they never have to come back out and fix anything. Lots of different looks, too. If you don't like the look of just common standing seam, you can have a number of different colors, or you can have roofs that look like slate or ceramic tile or lots of different materials, but it's actually that great quality metal that's going to last a lifetime. Southwest Metal Roofing Systems roofs are energy efficient. They'll save you money on your utility bills. Most insurance companies will give you a discount when you have one of their roofs on your home, because they know they're not going to be paying claims. And Southwest Metal Roofing Systems does new construction as well as roof replacement. So if you're building a new home, why not put on the only roof you'll ever have to put on that home? Quality roof from Southwest Metal Roofing Systems. Learn more by giving them a call at 210-822-6868. That's 210-822-6868 for Southwest Metal Roofing Systems.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening, and let's just go straight back to the phone lines. Going to be Clint, and then Robin, and then you, if you dial quickly, 210-599-5555. Good morning, Clint.
Good morning. How you doing?
Off to a good start. Another pretty day out there.
Oh, most definitely. You know, the more I listen to you, the more questions I come winding up with here.
Well, that's what I'm here for. So how can I help today?
The cedar repellent, is that the name, or is that Cedarside the same thing? Or
Cedarside's just a different brand. The cedar repel has just gotten to be a little bit easier to find. It's one of the products from Nature's Creation, and it's one that just about every nursery can find without any problem. The old Cedarside, it's hard to find sometimes, but cedar repel, most every nursery will have it on their shelves.
Okay, I just tried to Google it. Nothing really came up under cedar repel. It was kind of strange.
Well, I went in and checked the shelves before I did their commercial just to be sure. And, it's out there. In fact, it comes in a little sprayer. You're ready to stick on the end of the hose and go.
I think you said also granules?
Yeah, also comes as granules. I think it depends on what you're fighting. If you're putting something in beds, hoping to keep away snakes and things like that, the granulars are better. If you're spraying your grass to take care of the chiggers, the liquid is very definitely better.
I'm trying to keep the skeeters away.
Well, you can go either way. If you're having a big party, the liquid will be much faster acting. It would take a lot of the dry. It is pretty effective at repelling them, but at what cost? I tend to use a good deep free personal repellent, and then going to be entertaining or something like that. Yeah, the cedar repel is a good thing to spray around the yard an hour or two before the gathering.
All right, good deal. I did listen to that other guy. I think he was up in the hill country. I identified one of my aggravating plants. So that's that silver leaf nightshade.
Oh yeah. No, they. I don't know how you get rid of that totally. It's just the bane of the hill country for most every grower out there, every hay grower.
Right. Now there's another grass that's a weed grass that looks real similar to Johnson grass. However, the root ball can get up to about 10 inches in diameter. What kind of weed, grassy weed, is that?
Almost would have to.
Grass, I'm guessing.
There's big blue stem, although most people consider that a desirable native grass. Crabgrass tends to stay pretty small. It's Johnson grass will grow 4 or 5 feet tall. Crabgrass or rescue grass, as some people call it, it rarely gets over 6 or 8 inches, and it can be a nuisance in a lawn or places like that. In a pasture, I figure it holds the soil in place until your, better rangeland grass can kind of take over. But if it's a really big leaf, I'd be looking at big blue stem or a couple of the different native grasses.
Okay. Now, the garden last year, I stolarized half of it, and it stayed pretty good, but I guess the compost and the growing grain kicked in, and I got the best looking weeds ever again.
Well, problem is those weeds, the seeds blow in, and Mother Nature hates bare ground, so she keeps planting stuff. That's why I love my push-pull hoe. But my old buddy Alton Grimm used to always say, I would worry about any soil that didn't have some weeds in it. So it's it just makes certain that we don't get overconfident, that we get plenty of exercise.
And now, would that weed fabric be all right in
no.
holes where you need to plant stuff, or that wouldn't do any good?
It tends to just ruin the soil underneath it. I use it where I want to kill everything. If I want to expand, if I want to add another row or two to the garden, I'll put that down for a year. When you pull it up, because it cuts off oxygen as well as cutting off water, the soil just is just nasty what it turns the soil into. You can bring it back. But only time I'm ever going to use a weed block is on a temporary basis just to smother everything underneath it. As a matter of fact, years ago we put some down in a bed here at the nursery and then covered it up with rock. I was pulling weeds out of that rock bed yesterday, and the weeds had put their roots right through the so-called weed block fabric. And just the devil to get them up. It may stop things from coming up underneath, although it will not stop nutsedge. But to me, it's very bad for the soil and a total waste of time as far as preventing weeds.
Okay, and so a big outdoor greenhouse with, I don't know, screen wire around, you let it breathe, wouldn't keep the seeds and weeds out?
It may be. Again, if you're not planting in the ground, but it just makes a mess out of the ground. If you, in a greenhouse situation, if you were going to put that down and then put rock or gravel or something on top of it, I guess it probably wouldn't really harm anything that much. But it's just, it just will turn the soil underneath it into just an anaerobic, you know, antimicrobial situation. And I don't know. I other than a temporary use to just kill everything, I've never seen it really beneficial in any application.
Well, I wasn't looking for a typical greenhouse where you would grow, you know, out of pots and stuff, but just the greenhouse has a weed block and still using the soil itself.
It depends.
Completely enclosed, like screen wire or something, so it can still breathe and it won't get so hot. So I was kind of thinking.
Well, if you put rock of any sort on top of it, it makes it so slick. And like I say, I don't know. I just have never found a reason that it was something I really wanted to put down in an area in a greenhouse that I want to keep weed free. Boy, once in the spring with the orange oil and vinegar is going to knock out every weed that's trying to come up. For a lot less money, and I think you end up long term with a lot healthier thing. Even in a greenhouse, I think it's great to have healthy soil underneath the benches. And weed block, you're just never going to have healthy soil underneath weed block.
Well, no, I wasn't going to use a weed block. Would you have the the garden that's enclosed where the weeds can't get into it, but still using the existing soil? It's just kind of a barrier.
Well, you can certainly do that. My bigger garden, and I just, haven't had time to grow much of a garden for a couple of years, but I would go around the outside edge of it with about a 3-foot wide strip. I just use black plastic if I want to do that. I guess you could use the weed block, but if you're trying to temporarily keep things out, but I tell you, the Bermuda grass will go right over the top of it. It's if you're fighting Bermuda and you're down in Bermuda country, I'm going to tell you in that case, I think plastic will do better than the weed block will for you. Just a good old 6 mil like they use pouring concrete and things.
Okay. All right. Well, I appreciate your time. You have a good weekend.
You do the same, Clint. It's always good to hear from you. Appreciate you calling. So you're certainly welcome. Goodbye. Robin, hang on just a second. You will be up next, but it looks like I get to talk about Kinetico. I love my Kinetico water softener. I recommend it so highly for a lot of different reasons. I know there are lots and lots of water softener companies out there, and everybody I know except Kinetico, they run on electricity, which is fine as long as you have electricity, but if the power goes out, your water softener stops working. If you get a power surge or a close lightning strike, well, you're probably going to burn out that little computer on that kind of water softener, and then you're in for big trouble and expensive repairs. Kinetico systems run on the kinetic energy in the water. They have no need for electricity. They do not plug in, and they're immune to power outages and power surges, so to speak. They run on the kinetic energy, so you've always got soft water. The other thing I love about them is they don't recharge on a preset schedule. They only recharge when the rosin needs to be recharged. That's going to save you salt. That's going to save a lot of water, which is so important. And it's going to save you a lot of money as well. Plus, they're very reasonably priced. They're so sure you'll like them, they'll even give you 90 days to try them just to be sure. If you're looking for the last water softener you're ever going to own, you need to look at Kinetico. You can give them a call at 210-656-PURE, or you can check them out online if you'd like at KineticoSA.com. Tell them you want a water softener like I have. It's a water softener that will last a lifetime for you, be minimum maintenance, and give you that same great soft water you're looking for, a Kinetico.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster, News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening. My next three callers are going to be Robin and Danny and Paul. Let's get started with Robin. Good morning, Robin.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
Good morning. I have a question about Aspidistra.
Okay.
I read on the internet that it was very hard to divide, and I thought that was strange since it's such a hardy plant. I have two beautiful ones in pots, and they need to be taken out of the pots and divided. What is the best way to do that?
Ignore the internet. It's
okay.
I can't imagine. They are a little slow growing, and consequently they're a little more expensive, but they're not called cast iron plant just to have a name for them. They're pretty tough, and you can pretty much divide them at will. Now, when you divide them, it's going to take a few months before they really look full and beautiful again. But I don't know any reason not to divide them. And if you do it at the right time of year, and I'm not real sure what it is, I think it's late summer, you may actually get to see the flowers when you divided them, because they have an interesting maroon-red flower, but it never comes above the surface of the ground. And people are sometimes really amazed when they go to divide their Aspidistra and they find flowers underneath the ground. So don't hesitate to divide. Like I say, it's going to, you know, if you have full gorgeous pots and you divide, it's going to take a few months before they're really full and beautiful again. But don't let that stop you. It's you're certainly not going to kill them dividing them. I don't know why anybody would say they were hard to divide. They're pretty easy to divide. You'll have to have some pretty strong pruning shears, because that underground rhizome is tough and hardy, but you'll do just fine dividing them. Don't hesitate there, Robin. You'll do okay.
Okay, I was just going to take a knife and cut through them.
You can do that. Do it very carefully, because they are tough, and you know, it needs to be a very strong knife, like a hunting knife or fillet, or you know, something that's really tough, almost like a bayonet.
Wow.
I tend to, if I were going to do it, I probably would just use some good strong pruning shears. Be a lot safer.
Okay, thank you. And one more question. I have some cannas, and the leaves are wavy.
Mm-hmm.
They just don't look right. And they came back this year. They were that way last year. And I thought, well, they won't come back that way, but they did. They're just wavy leaves, and they just, you know, they don't look right.
Probably just due to the cool lights. As we get into hotter summer weather, the leaves should, you know, flatten out and become perfectly normal in appearance. You have to watch them for caterpillars. There's a big black fuzzy caterpillar called a woolly bear that loves to chew on them, and it'll sometimes cause the leaves to come out distorted. But if they're just not unrolling, if they're just kind of crinkly looking, I think it's probably just the weather. I'm not aware of any virus issues that cannas get. There's some other plants I'd worry about virus if I were seeing that. But I think that they're just waiting for hot weather to really put on their best show. I think it's just cool mornings and cool overnight temperatures is why they aren't as flat-leaved as you're used to.
And it's interesting because I have like four different kinds of cannas, mm-hmm. and this one is the only one that does that. It's just a dark green plain one. I think it gives a red flower. I find it strange.
Every one of them's going to be a little different. Are these dwarf cannas, or are they the big, tall growing ones?
They should be big and tall. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think it's probably just weather, and it's just varietal. The cannas that I like are the newer ones that are a little bit more compact. They come in a lot of colors nowadays. I think they're calling them Fitzer's cannas or something like that. And there's some beautiful variegated cannas out there as well. People have done some really good hybridizing in those things. But I think when the weather warms up, even more, when it gets to be the kind of weather where you and I are a little bit uncomfortable, I think your cannas will be perfect.
What did you say the compact ones are called?
I believe they're the most common series is called Fitzer's, Fitzer. Yeah,
okay.
But there are several different compact ones out there, and gosh, the colors are just beautiful, and there's nothing that loves the sun more than a canna, but take a look at some of the variegated ones as well. Most of those have orange flowers, but they'll have just practically every shade of red and purple and yellow in the leaves. They're gorgeous plants, even when they're not in bloom.
I have one. It's fantastic. I just grow it for the leaves. It's so beautiful. Yeah.
And then the blooms are just a bonus.
Right. Okay. Thank you so much and appreciate your program greatly.
Well, it is my great pleasure to be here for you, and I appreciate you calling. You have a great Memorial Day weekend.
You too. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much. Goodbye. All right. Let's see. Jimmy, are we up to Danny? Is that my next caller?
Yes, sir.
I believe that's right. Good morning, Danny.
It's not Danny. It's Janie.
Janie, okay, well, I know the voice, even if the name was written down wrong. How's Janie this morning?
How are you doing?
Oh, I'm great. It's just, it's just these mornings, they're just close to perfect. You know, this time last year, we were already pushing 100 degrees. It was, I didn't look this morning, but yesterday morning, it was 66 degrees on the porch, and boy, that was comfortable.
Well, that's good. Well, my question is, you were talking to a young man about weeds
mm-hmm.
to put, okay. Well, my question is, I've got flowers all against the fence, but the weeds come back every year, and this year they really came back. And it's getting harder for me because I've been doing this for like 60 years, maybe more.
Mm-hmm.
And it's getting harder. And I was thinking, I saw it at somewhere where they had granules,
mm-hmm.
Rocks real small to cover the bed. But you said something that's not really a good idea, right?
Well, I like rocks, you know, as a decorative cover on the soil. I think any kind of mulch, it's not necessarily going to totally prevent weeds. It'll certainly make them easier to pull. But weeds are just, Mother Nature hates bare ground. And if you have bare soil, she's going to send in a few weeds to keep it from washing away. But if you want to put down anything from pea gravel to decayed granite to lava sand, all of those things will very definitely suppress the weeds. And it'll make it a lot easier to pull up any of them that do show up, my choice would probably be lava sand, because, you know, it's a granular material. It's nice looking. It helps hold moisture or bring moisture to the soil even. And it has what we call a high cation exchange capacity. It helps hold nutrients in the soil until your plants are ready to use them. So I don't know that I would be buying something like that over the internet, but lava sand is something you can find at most any nursery, and it's going to be a good product to help your plants and suppress the weeds at the same time.
Well,
plus today you don't go ahead.
I'm sorry. No, I was thinking I put in some of that material, that black material.
No, don't do that. Don't do that. That'll ruin the soil underneath it, and your flowers won't grow well. And it won't stop the weeds. The weeds will blow in and germinate on top of it. It might keep things from coming up from underneath, but I've seen some real weed patches. I've seen it in everything from plastic grass to, places where people put down. They call it weed block fabric, and like I say, it might stop a few of the weeds coming up from underneath, but, boy, the weed seeds land on top, and they just love it. And they are hard to pull out. They get their roots down through that fabric, and it's really hard to pull those weeds out or even to cut them off.
So what is that sand that I could get?
It's called lava sand. It's just a very fine granular lava, and it suppresses the weeds, and what weeds come up through it, they'll be much easier to pull up, and it's actually very good for the soil rather than being bad for the soil.
Okay, I got another question. I've got a rose bush that I like a whole lot. I cut some pieces and put them in a pot so mm-hmm. that I could get some more of those roses. But I have it under a tree because I've heard that you don't put it out there where the sun is. Is that
That's correct? Yes, ma'am, that is correct. Once they get some roots going, then they will love the sun, but they will root much better in a shady spot. You're absolutely right. You probably inherited your mother or your grandmother's touch where you can root well in soil. I've always rooted rose cuttings in that white volcanic material called perlite, but you give it a try that way. If for whatever reason they don't root well, call me and we'll talk about using perlite to root your cuttings. But no, in a shady spot.
That.
Yeah.
I tried that, but I didn't have no luck with it. I don't know why, but I just didn't. I've got it under the tree, and it's been like that for about 2 weeks, and I'm waiting for it to grow up, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It hasn't gotten up higher. So I said, how long does it take for the
normally, roots? Normally about 6 weeks. About six weeks for them to form good roots.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot, Bob. You helped me a lot, and I'm glad that man asked you about the weeds. Like I said, I'm already going to be 86 this month, and I can't do it as much as I do.
Well, maybe not, but that's what keeps you young, Janie. So I think you're 86 years young, not 86 years old. So keep gardening, and we'll be talking about 106 one of these days.
All right. You have a good day, okay?
You do the same, Janie. It's always good to hear from you. Thank you so much.
Goodbye. Bye-bye.
All right, let's get a break out of the way here, and Paul will be next in line. Looks like I get to talk to you about Medina Agriculture, and you know I love talking about Medina. 56, 57 years, something like that. They've been helping gardeners around the world, right here from our part of the world. Medina Ag started just west of San Antonio. Their plant's over just outside of Hondo, and let me tell you, they make a lot of great products, whether you're working on 1,000 acres or whether you're working on your backyard. Great fertilizers like both of the Grow and Green products, liquid products like the Has to Grow products. Their liquid fish blend is an outstanding product for plants in containers as well as for flower beds and vegetable gardens and things like that. Medina also makes products to soften and loosen the soil like the Medina Plus and the original Medina Soil Activator. And when it comes to packaging different products, I can't say they make orange oil or molasses, but they sure package some of the best out there. If you want to see a complete list of their products, simply go to MedinaAg.com. find these products at your favorite nursery or garden center, but do keep in mind they don't do any good while they're still staying in the bag or bottle. You've got to get them out on your landscape, and this is going to be a great weekend to get out and make use of fine products from Medina. That's Medina Agriculture.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening. Getting close to 8 o'clock, at which point we will have our visit with the Dirt Doctor, but time for probably a couple of more calls. Paul is in line first. If you want to grab one of those lines, probably time for a couple of calls. You know the number, 210-599-5555. And let's say good morning, Paul.
It is. Beautiful morning. Thanks,
yes,
Bob.
It is. Thank you.
I'm seeing, last year I saw some, and this year again, as real small black ants.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with what those might be and anything to worry about?
Oh, there are so many different kinds of ants. As long as they're not fire ants, I wouldn't be overly concerned about them. They're in the house, you know, sugar ants can be something of a problem. We make a bait for them. Usually with borax and sugar. Outside, of course, beneficial nematodes will take care of, I think, every kind of ant around. But they're not destructive in any way, I guess it probably would be the best way to put it. They may become a nuisance, but they're not anything that I would really worry about.
Okay, because they're in the pots. It's where I saw them last year and then again this year. And I was looking at the key lime.
Uh-huh.
And they're just, you know, very small, very active, and thousands of them. So, but they're in pots is where I typically see them.
I would worry that they may be fire ants, because fire ants really love to get in pots like that, and they will ultimately kind of waterproof the soil. Your plants will not do well if they start putting a colony in there. I would make up a very dilute solution of orange oil and water. I put maybe to a gallon of water, I put a teaspoon or two of orange oil in there and just pour that through the plants. Don't make it any stronger. You could burn the roots of things if you use too much orange oil. But that should kill the ants without bothering your plants at all. But no, I really wouldn't want colonies of any kind of ants in the pots. Now, if you have pots that don't have plants in them but are full of soil, waiting to be planted for the warm season or something, then you can make a stronger solution of orange oil and kill them even more quickly. But where you have existing things like citrus trees and things like that, make it fairly dilute, maybe a tablespoon per gallon. Just use that to water your plants, and that will generally get rid of the ants.
Okay, so a tablespoon per gallon orange
teaspoon.
Oil.
Teaspoon per teaspoon. Gallon of orange
okay.
oil, yeah.
The reason I was down to look at that plant is I got two leaves. One is curled up quite tight, and then the other one's right next to it starting to curl up. What am I seeing there?
If you unroll that leaf, does it have any webbing inside of it, or is it just green leaf that's kind of rolled on itself?
No, there's something growing in there. It's not webbing, but something appears to be taking
yeah.
root there.
It's probably a caterpillar of some sort. They kind of roll it around them and kind of stitch them together. Probably not a serious problem. If you want to spray a little spinosad, I think you'll control them pretty quickly that way. The other thing that can cause leaves to roll, number one, is just wind and low humidity. Sometimes real cool nighttime temperatures will cause the leaves to roll to some extent. But if they're really tightly rolled, there probably is a little insect of some sort in there. And spinosad is what I would use to control them.
Okay, because I lost one last year to scale, just got totally just lost the plant. Oh, we didn't want that happen to this one.
Yeah, well, spinosad soap. The thing about scale, once a scale matures, it sort of armors itself. It puts a thick, almost a shell, like, over itself, and can be hard to get anything to go through that. But the young scale are what we call crawlers. They're actually moving. They're actually active, moving around for a place that they're looking to settle down, so to speak, and produce more. Spinosad soap sprayed every couple of weeks. If you see any scale, will usually totally take care of the problem.
Okay. Got it. Thank you, Bob.
It's always a pleasure. You get out and enjoy your Memorial Day. Thanks for the call, Paul. Appreciate
take
it.
Care, Bob.
You too. Bye. All right. I don't really have time for another call. We're down to just a little over a minute before news time. We'll remind you that we are in the middle of our drive we call Operation Interdependence over at KTSA, co-sponsored by Kitchen Designs by Giovanni, and collecting items that our troops overseas, around the world, at home, troops everywhere have needs that we have the pleasure of helping them out with. So virtually all of our sponsors are drop-off locations for items. And just go to KTSA.com. You'll find a complete list of the things that troops would like to receive, and just a good thing to do. And this goes on till the 4th of July, and it's never a bad time to be thankful for all the freedoms we have. We remember the men and women that have given their lives this weekend to ensure that we can continue to live in freedom. And anyway, it's just Memorial Day is something certainly worth celebrating. Operation Interdependence is a good thing to do to help out our troops that are out there on the front lines protecting us these days. And just right after the news here, we'll be visiting with the Dirt Doctor, Mr. Howard Garrett, so hope you'll stick around. We'll save the last 30 minutes or so of the show for more questions, and of course we do this again tomorrow morning. But right now, hoping you're making plans to get out and enjoy, because it is a beautiful day out there. This is KTSA Radio in San Antonio, Texas.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
All right, now, because, we'll save the last 30 minutes or so of the show for more questions, and then we'll do all this again tomorrow morning with those questions. But right now, we have the pleasure of talking to the Dirt Doctor. Good morning, Howard Garrett.
Good morning, gardeners.
It is a beautiful day out there.
Same here. It's very nice. We don't even have a lot of mosquitoes around. I did spray some liquid cedar product around all over the place. I started to put out garlic also, but I didn't notice a lot of mosquitoes, so I just left it like that. So far, so good, knock on wood.
Well, it just all depends on the day. I swear, sometimes it seems like the gnats are what are driving me crazier than the mosquitoes have been lately. And I think the garlic, I think the cedar, things like that help at least to some degree with that. But I was out doing some weed eating yesterday, and let me tell you what, it was the gnats that were making my life miserable.
And the gnats are interesting. I wonder, you know, we still don't have a good consumer size on the market, but the liquid BTI sprayed around would probably take care of those gnats.
I would think so. It certainly works on, you know, the fungus gnats that get in the soil of plants. It works on the sewer gnats that get down in, you know, pea traps underneath our sinks and things like that. And I quite honestly, I'm not sure. I'm sure they come out of the soil, but I'm not real sure what the best way to go after the others are. And it's just, I don't know how they can try to get into your eyes, to try to get into your ears. Anybody who spends a lot of time outside certainly knows what we're talking about.
Yeah, it's there's always some kind of pest running around. It seems to be varying this year. I'm seeing a few holes in leaves of plants and hit-and-run artists, and those gnats and also ants. People are getting a lot of reports about various kinds of sugar ants, small ants. I heard one of your listeners call about that same thing. They might try the cinnamon dusted or cinnamon mixed in water and sprayed out. Is a pretty good repellent, and of course those boric acid laced baits work pretty well also.
Just I think boric acid is a little toxic on plants, so I recommend that inside frequently. In fact, tell people you can make your own with a little boric acid and sugar. I've had people that mixed boric acid with a little bit of orange juice and said that that worked well against carpenter ants. So They're people don't have to turn to all the poisons to get them under control. That's a good thing.
Yeah, the commercial companies, the one I work with, uses a bait that's a borate based product. It's a little less toxic than just pure boric acid, so that's another way to go as well. And I've had luck in the past, and for some reason it seems to vary in its efficacy, but the mixture of Arm & Hammer detergent and sugar, kind of a 50-50 mix, will attract and kill roaches. And I don't know if that kind of put around dusted where people are having a real problem with ants inside the house, not so much outside. That might also be an effective way to go. But
it would certainly be worth a try. Well, tell us how the open house, how all that went.
Well, it was good. We had a great group of people that came by. Everybody was interested in all the stuff. We're going to have three more videos. I've shot them. They haven't been put up yet, but they'll be put up in the members area on on DirtDoctor.com, showing the metal sculpture. Ace Cordell, who is the metal sculpture artist, brought about four more pieces over yesterday.
Wow.
And they look great. And my garden's going to be a real battle with myself to not buy more of them. I already own two of them. And then my buddy that does the wood sculpture, he did some beautiful inlaid little tables and bowls and all there. And so I shot all those, all that stuff into videos that'll be in the members area sometime as soon as Maggie can get it put up. So another good reason to join the Organic Club of America.
It's just such a reasonable price, and you get so much in return. And, you're just supporting a very good cause when you do that. And when you buy the art, you're supporting the Organic Club of America and Torque. So there are just all sorts of good things going on around the Garrett household these days.
Yeah, if anybody's interested in anything they see in the videos and weren't at the event last night, they can email me, info@dirtdoctor.com or howard@dirtdoctor.com, either one, and we can send information about the pricing and how it all works, all that kind of thing. But anyway, it was fun. It was a really good group that showed up, and weather was good, and the mosquitoes didn't decide to come. I tell people all the time, and I'm sure you do too, that mosquitoes are so tough to control because they can adapt to anything.
Yep.
And it doesn't matter. I think even BTI, they have a tendency to be able to adapt to it. You know, the traps, the stagnant water in 5-gallon buckets with BTI put in it seems to work just perfectly for a while, and then all of a sudden, one day, here you see a bunch of mosquitoes show up again. And I don't know whether they get smart enough to, or whatever, to avoid it, or whether they can actually become immune to the BTI.
Well, I wish that someday, somehow, somebody would come up with a sort of a self-emptying trap that, like, every 3 days just dumps itself out and then refills with water, because that's the one thing they can't adapt to, and that is getting dumped out where they dry out before they've formed the adult. And that will always work. And if the BTI stops working and, dumping your traps periodically, what does it take? In most cases, 2 or 3 days. How long does it take from the time a egg is laid until the adult mosquito hatches out or becomes
about
an adult
time,
mosquito?
It's a short, short period of time. So.
Yeah.
And I guess it varies depending on what species of mosquito it is.
Yeah. One
question.
Go ahead.
I had one question for you on turf. I'm just curious. You talk about drought-tolerant grasses, and you don't mention buffalo grass. Is there something I'm missing there? Because buffalo grass is about twice as drought tolerant as Bermuda grass.
Yeah, well, and the problem that I have seen, and no, buffalo grass, I definitely should mention it more, but most people have at least some Bermuda, and our experience with buffalo grass is it just doesn't compete well with Bermuda, and if Mother Nature gives us good rains and all, the Bermuda always seems to manage to dominate it. Now, if you can get a pure stand of it and keep the Bermuda out, it's an outstanding grass, but we've had a number of customers that just almost gave up and let the Bermuda dominate. Now, in droughty conditions, which we've certainly had the past couple of years, yeah, the buffalo, the turf type buffalo grasses, you know, do real well. But it's just been a matter of competition with Bermuda, and the Bermuda has won out in a number of yards where people I know have tried to maintain a pure stand of buffalo grass, and they've had trouble with it.
Well, it's kind of a personal point to me because the universities, that one in Texas especially, keeps bad-mouthing buffalo grass from the standpoint of Bermuda invading, and I've never worried about that at all. I've seen a lot of lawns and a lot of commercial places where the buffalo grass and Bermuda are growing together, and I don't have a problem with that. I don't quite understand that objection. And if you don't fertilize and if you don't water so much, the buffalo will actually dominate the Bermuda grass.
Yeah, we probably need to go more. I did not realize that certain institution that we don't care so much for, I didn't realize that they were putting that out as well. But and it may just be that the people have gotten a little carried away with fertilizing and watering. But it just hasn't caught on down here, I guess you'd say. And I need to research a little bit more and find out why it's not more commonly used. But most of the turf companies don't grow it down around here, so I definitely need to do some more research there. I certainly will.
Well, it's a paradigm problem. It's what it is. The way that the turf grasses are grown, they fertilize the heck out of it.
Yeah.
And to get it, you know, into a sellable form as quickly as they can, and then that's passed on to the contractors and to the homeowners. And, you know, a lot of it is how much fertilizer can we sell? I think that's part of it. And buffalo grass is just such an incredibly low-maintenance grass. You can literally stop watering it, and it can go through months of 100-degree weather. And it'll be brown. It'll be that orangey, golden, brown, and as soon as it gets watered, it comes right back. Bermuda won't do that. Bermuda will die. So it's by far the toughest of the grasses. I really have been on a campaign for a long time. I should have mentioned this to you before, maybe this way, but
I will research it further. I don't know. We don't see it advertised or offered very often, and people may just not be using it correctly, and they may be, you know, increasing the fertility too much. I based my comments on a handful of situations, but I can't say that I've researched it widely, and I definitely will do more of it and find out. I know people have done this HabiTurf that they came up with up in Austin. Has turned out to be pretty popular for people that just want a, you know, a grass that they just be more of a no-mow type of grass situation. And it looks more like, you know, almost a pasture grass, but it's turned out to be one of the lowest maintenance combinations that we've found around this place. And that's probably the most popular where people are looking for something that just doesn't need water and doesn't need much maintenance at all. So, but I'll take a new look at the buffalo grasses and see what people think of them down here.
Well, of course, the main one of the main ingredients in that mix you're talking about is buffalo grass.
Exactly, so, along with curly mesquite.
It's
and, just, yeah.
Yeah, it's just like the fact that we have so few people other than, you know, you and me and the organic community recommending the organic stuff because it's not taught in the universities. And it's the same thing with buffalo grass. The universities are bad-mouthing buffalo grass, and it then goes to the contractors, and then that goes to the retail stores, and that goes to the homeowners. But it's without question, whether you lay it solid sod or put it in by seed, it's my recommended way to go.
Well, if A&M doesn't like it, that's a big point in favor for me liking it. So I'll have to take
big mouth, bad mouth it. They don't like it at all. And I think a big part of it is the relationship to the industry, the paradigm, and the way things are set. And there's always this, aversion to changing the paradigm, doing something completely different. Of course, it won't grow in the shade, but Bermudagrass won't grow in the shade either. So
exactly. Yep. Yep, it's kind of like the same ones that say, "Oh, don't fertilize early, and plant your grass and wait 30 days before you fertilize it." And tell people with organics, put your fertilizer down first, and then plant whatever kind of grass you like. And you and I are both big fans of fertilizing much earlier in the year. So I will definitely research it further, and we'll have ongoing discussions about it. One thing that I kind of laugh at, and you tell me what you think, totally different subject, but somebody out there is promoting that if people will just put a few pots of lemongrass and maybe some of the citronella geranium around, that the mosquitoes won't come around. And I've not found that growing the plants, unless you have just a forest of them, has really worked that well. But there's somebody out there saying, "Oh yeah, you just put a pot of lemongrass on your patio and you'll never have mosquitoes." Do you think the there's anything to that?
No, it's the same thing that we were just talking about. It's a promotion, a commercial promotion to sell those plants.
Right.
You can plant the whole yard in those plants, and it won't repel mosquitoes. No, it doesn't do any good at all. You've got to have the active ingredient in the plant available, the essential oil or whatever sprayed for it to do any good. Same thing with garlic. People say, planting garlic in their vegetable garden around tomatoes and around plants will help ward off insects, and there's nothing to that at all. Absolutely nothing at all. You've got to have the ingredients in the garlic sprayed and touching the plants for it to do any good.
Well, I'm glad I'm not mistaken on that, because it's just daily. We have people that think if they plant lemon verbena or lemongrass or citronella geraniums or whatever, that they won't ever have a mosquito problem again. My line is always, if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is, and that's been exactly my experience with that. So I'm glad to hear that you've had the same experience with that. They make some great products out of them. Some of the repellents and things like that of the extracted oils. But what my common line has been to tell people, well, I must say I've never seen a mosquito land on a on a citronella, but they sure do buzz around it a lot. So yeah, that's been our experience as well. You probably also
the lemongrass and the lemon verbena and the lemon balm, they're great to put in your herb tea. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that they're going to repel any insects in your garden.
And that's my feeling. And I love Thai food, and they use, of course, a lot of lemongrass in that. And they're very good things to do with it, but it's, again, it's somebody's just promotion that if you just have a few of those, you won't have any mosquitoes. So I'm glad that your experience has been the same, because if it were that easy, we sure wouldn't have the mosquito problems that we do. One other thing I had a caller early this morning ask about was, he mentioned that in crepe myrtles that some of them shedding bark, which it told him is perfectly normal, but said he had what looked like some little tunnels, some little frass underneath the bark. And I have never seen ants be that much of a problem. Or at first he thought it was termites, but I said, no, I don't think it'd ever be a termite. Do you know of any kind of borer or anything that's ever a problem in crepe myrtles?
No, I've seen that a little tiny bit here and there, but it's always on a crepe myrtle that's in stress.
Yeah.
That's too deep in the ground, which is what, you know, most crepe myrtles are. Most
yeah, of, that's exactly what I told them.
You get them, and then plant it too deeply, but that would just be a minor cosmetic kind of thing, even if you have it. The big problem, and the advice on what to do about it is just horrible, is that white scale insect that gets on the trees. And I've seen that here in Dallas fair amount, but it's never on trees except the ones that are too deep in the ground and are in stress.
Yep. And that goes for aphids. That goes for most of the other things that show up. But I think we see that virtually 100% of the crepe myrtles out there are planted too deeply when they get to the nurseries, and then half the time the landscapers plant them even deeper. And that's certainly our recommendation. Take care of that problem, and everything else just kind of goes away.
Well, you know, one of the things that continues to be a problem related to this is that crepe myrtles are so darn tough, they can tolerate to a great degree the abuse of being too deep in the ground. And
for
it's just the last several years that the scale and the and aphids in some cases and related to both those things, the black sooty mole has become more and more of a problem. And I think it probably is because they are ending up being deeper and deeper in the pots or in the bald and burlap situation when the plants are purchased, and then on the site, you just get deeper and deeper in the ground. It's a big problem. It's not getting any better. In fact, the people in the growing industry that several of us have tried to talk to, they're not only not interested in solving the problem, they get mad at you if you bring it up.
Yeah.
It's a really, really curious situation.
Well,
in that category, besides crepe myrtles, the lace bark elms and the Chinese pistachios and some of those kind of trees, the hybrid maples, that's another problem. Of course, they're a bad plant to start with, and then they get planted too deep in addition to that, and you end up with a maximum life of those things of about 10 years or something.
Right.
It's a huge problem that's not getting any better.
Well, and I think so much of it started when so many of the growers stopped paying their help hourly wages and started paying by the piece. And so they're the only incentive to see how fast you can do it. And it's a whole lot easier just to grab that, you know, row run or grab that seedling or whatever, stick it all the way down in the pot and dump the soil around it, move on to the next one. And I think that has contributed a great deal to the problems. And I don't know why. I guess crepe myrtles and trees is just the nature of handling them. We don't see it quite as much in shrubs that are branched from the base, like viburnums and pittosporum and things like that. But, boy, the trees and the crepe myrtles, it's just like you say, 100% of them, you know, start out too deep. And they, like they say, they tolerate it for a while, but it's just amazing how much better they do when they wind up at the right level. And we tell people, you know, expose it and actually put them slightly above ground level. And people who do that seem to have extremely good results with them.
Well, I think that deal that you're talking about putting them too deep when they're planted, it probably, one is, like you're saying, it goes faster. But two is, I think they actually do it on purpose to a degree because it holds it straight up and
props
in
them
the pot better. It doesn't flop over. And when you have a plant that's planted too deeply in the soil, it tends to grow more like a ground sprout, real straight. And a lot of the landscape architects and other people buying the plants, like that incredibly straight growth of the trunk. I prefer more interesting trunks myself, but the industry likes them straighter. Straighter the better, and so sticking them real deep in the soil, I think, kind of helps create that situation.
That would make sense as well. And on crepe myrtles, you know, I recommend, in fact, most things like that. I tell people that I prefer to see a multi-trunk plant, because how many times have we seen a single-trunk crepe myrtle or other things that gets the top snapped out of it in a storm, and then it takes a long time, if ever, for the plant to look nice again. And I think on a multi-trunk crepe myrtle, I don't think I've ever seen storm damage on them. And so that's another thing I tell people about. Some people, like you say, just want that single trunk look, but long term, I don't think it works out as well.
Well, you know, that plant is naturally a bush, rather than a tree, really. So that's why you get a better situation if you got the multi-trunks on the crepe myrtles. I normally don't recommend multi-trunk trees because you end up with real tight V's at the bottom and things like that. I learned that the hard way. I used to design gardens and specifically put on the plan in my specs for the red oaks to be multi-trunk.
Yeah.
And I created a lot of problems because those multi-trunks end up having tight V's and problems and part of the tree trying to fall apart at some point. But crepe myrtle is a different story because they're bushes, really.
Oh, yeah. Whole different story, and I feel the same way about citrus. People that want good production, and, of course, you guys don't grow as much citrus in the landscape, and I don't know, there probably won't be as much planted after our two cold winters, but up until 2021, you walk around the neighborhoods and see beautiful lemons and various other things. But I always tell people, you know, if you want the most production, you want to get the maximum number of fruits, it's always going to be from a bush, not from a single trunk tree.
Well, we'll try to keep up the fight.
And remember to tell your listeners tomorrow that all across Texas, that this is the tax-free weekend, and all plants are exempt from sales tax, along with soils, mulches, compost. And anytime we can save 8% or so, depending on how much your local tax is, it's not a bad thing. So a good reason to get out and visit a good nursery this weekend.
I think that's a great plan.
Very good. Well, Howard, it's always a pleasure. Hope you have a wonderful Memorial Day, and give all the pets a pet for me and all the ladies a hug, and we'll look forward to doing it again next Saturday.
Enjoyed it, and we'll see you next time. You guys enjoy those healthy gardens out there.
We'll do our very best. Thank you, sir. Glad your event went well. I'd love look forward to seeing some videos of it. And anyway, look forward to our next visit. And everybody else, we've got about 25 minutes left in the show. Time for some more phone calls. You know the number, 210-599-5555. We need to get a commercial break in here, and we'll be right back with calls.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 1071.
All right, back to a few more minutes of gardening. Looks like we're going to talk to Jay and Kim and Chris. If you're just joining me, remember that this is the weekend. They call it Water Saver, but it's more than just things that save water. But all plants are sales tax free today, tomorrow, and Monday. Mulches, compost, soil, drip irrigation, all those products are without sales tax this weekend. So if you got a big gardening project going on, or if you just want to stock up on a bunch of compost and other things, you'll save that tax for the next 3 days. So keep that in mind. Let's get back to the phone calls. Looks like it's going to be Jay and Kim and Chris. And Jay is first in line. Good morning, Jay.
Morning, Bob. I have a
Good
couple
morning,
quick
sir.
Questions.
Okay.
When would be the best time to prune my sage and take cuttings for it to propagate it?
Best time to take cuttings is typically in the fall, October, November. technically, you can do it anytime the wood is mature. You do not want that soft, succulent growth, but most of the commercial people, October is the month that they tend to take cuttings on both sage and on most woody shrubs. Now, we're talking what they call the purple sage, the Senesa. Is that the type of sage we're speaking of?
Yeah, the purple sage with the dark green foliage.
Yeah. As far as pruning, probably the best time is early spring. And if you're planting it, you know, grow the new compact forms that require very little pruning. But typically it blooms on new growth. Well, it may bloom some on old, but some on new. But if it really needs to be pruned, probably about February is going to be about the time to do it. And like I say, probably the best time to actually propagate it is going to be the October-November period.
Okay, and then propagate it with the air layers or perlite, and you said using the woody bark, not the new shoots?
Yeah, using the woodier part, and the commercial growers either use good coarse sand or use perlite. I guess you could air layer it, but the stems are thin enough that that's a little tougher to do. Air layering is usually done on something that's with a little bit thicker stem, but I don't know why you couldn't just, you know, slice some bark off the side, but it grows pretty easily from cuttings at that time of the year. I would take your cuttings, I'd soak them in Garrett juice, maybe even add a little bit of extra liquid seaweed to it for 30 minutes or so, and then you'll probably have about 60% success rate. Back in the days when I propagated for a big nursery up in Dallas, that's what we did. Probably got about 60% on Senesis.
Awesome, awesome. Okay, and thank you, Bob. And then I have some plumeria that I planted in, and I guess one of them had gotten a little too cold over the winter time while it was dug up out of the ground. I tried cutting it back. Is there any chance that it'll grow out of the half of the stem cut down to where there's not any of the green part where the leaves and the flowers pop out of?
Is the stem dry, or is the stem still have plenty of moisture in it?
It had plenty of moisture in it.
Yeah, it will probably come out. One thing that's good anytime you have freeze damage like that is dust it fairly heavily with cinnamon. The thing that usually winds up killing them is they get a bacterial infection in where that tissue starts to deteriorate. And believe it or not, cinnamon is one of the best antibacterial things we've got going out there. So I would, anywhere you cut, I dust it fairly heavily with just, kitchen cinnamon, and it most likely will come out for you.
Okay, awesome. Last question. I have a pomegranate tree. It is in full fruit, but the little pot that it's in is just, it gets tipped over quite a bit when we get storms. Is it safe to transplant it into a bigger pot while it's in fruiting? Or
yeah, it's you're not disturbing the roots, so that's just repotting is all you're doing. And if it is badly root bound on a woody shrub, you probably want to take a sheetrock knife or something or other and slice down one side of the root ball just to get the roots spreading out. But you can do that 365 days a year. And, of course, if you want to put it in the ground, pomegranates are pretty much 100% cold hardy here. And they make a bigger shrub that's easier to maintain. And if you're going to get quality fruit, you've got to water regularly. And it sounds like yours is root bound to the point that you're struggling to keep it watered. So I would very definitely either go to a bigger pot, not hugely bigger, but maybe 2 or 3 inches bigger in diameter, or, put it in the ground if you like. I think you get much better quality fruit either way and much less maintenance.
Yeah. Awesome, awesome. Yeah, I got about a dozen fruit from it last year, and I've probably got about 2 dozen on it this year. So
very
awesome,
good.
Bob, I appreciate it. Yes, sir.
Yeah. Just remember the moisture, because most people, they get plants that produce well, but then the fruit isn't real good quality, and that's a matter of just letting it get true dry between waterings. But sounds like you know what you're doing, so get out and enjoy. It's going to be a great weekend to repot, plant, anything else you want to do out there.
Have a great day, Bob.
You too, Jay. Thank you, sir. Goodbye. All right, next in line is Kim. Good morning, Kim.
Good morning, Bob. This is another question regarding plumerias.
Okay.
The gentleman from your last call, if he, hopefully he's still listening. As long as he got back to clean, the clean white wood where he had that nice milky sap, and make sure you set it at a 45 degree angle so that, you know, if it rains and stuff, water won't sit and get that pith all wet and, you know, cause continuous, you know, cause problems.
Good points. It sounds like you're a pretty good plumeria grower.
Oh, well, I've got a couple hundred around here, so
You must have a little Hawaiian blood in you somewhere back there.
I say I have a problem, but a little. Anyway, but I have a question. A friend of mine, actually, and he's a grower here in the area. He has a plumeria grove, and unfortunately, he was a victim of some overspray of a neighbor who was spraying a fence line with Roundup. Kind of got onto some of his plants, and he, at this point, and this was like last year, so now as they're coming back out, the leaves are deformed. He's getting, you know, just nothing is, everything's kind of smaller and irregular, you know, just, I guess, what you'd see from an herbicide damage. So my question to you is, and I kind of recommended the sick tree treatment to him, just to kind of get things going to see if there would be any way to reverse it. But I told him I'd give you a call to see if there's anything that you would recommend, or does he just, if he were to cut those tips off, would it help, or is this something that's already systemically in the plant? Anyway.
The plant will grow out of it. It will eventually, it hasn't messed up the genetics of the plant, so to speak. It's just a matter of getting the, you know, what they say about most forms of pollution is the answer to pollution is dilution. And that's the same thing with herbicide in a plant. As time goes on and it is more and more diluted and to some extent broken down, the better the plants will do. Now, there are microorganisms, bacteria in particular, that do denature and break down Roundup. If there's any, I can never say there's anything good about Roundup, but at least it's better than some of the other materials that just simply don't go away in nature. Some of these sulfonated urea herbicides, that just, they're going to be in the soil forever. At least Roundup does eventually break down, and anything that supports microbial life will help with that. So I would recommend, you know, spraying with some molasses. I would try to encourage as much growth as possible, because the plants will ultimately come out of it. They're not permanently deformed. And I don't know, it might help appearance-wise to cut off the very distorted areas, but I don't think that's necessarily going to help it come out any faster. And I don't think it's, you know, bleeding anything back down into the plant. This plant, it just... point, it just has to grow out of it, and eventually they will go back to making good growth. I would certainly be talking to the source of the overspray about a little compensation for all the pain and suffering that he's going through. But that's sadly a very common problem in today's world, from idiots that haven't learned not to use this stuff, including municipal districts as well as individuals. So that's just my feeling about it. But I certainly wouldn't give up on the plants. I think ultimately, 3-4 years down the road, you won't see a lot of sign of what happened.
All right. Well, I will definitely pass that on to him, and I appreciate the information.
In repotting, it might be good, and I don't know this for a fact, but when we're trying to remediate various kinds of damage, both from pesticides and from herbicides, charcoal seems to be a really good thing to have in the soil. So as he repots, or if he, if he bare roots, as so many people do, I would choose some fine textured charcoal. There's a brand out there called Norit, N-O-R-I-T, or in small quantities, you can probably go to an aquarium shop. I might experiment with doing some repotting and incorporate a fair amount of charcoal in the potting mix and see if that tends to get things back to a normal growth a little more quickly. I don't know whether it will or not, but it certainly wouldn't hurt anything.
All righty. I will definitely pass that on. Thank you so much.
Hey, it is always a pleasure. And get back to me. Let me know how he does with them, Kim. I'll look forward to hearing from you.
All right. Thank you.
You're certainly welcome. Thank you. Jimmy, let's get our last break out of the way, and then we'll probably finish the show up with Chris.
How can you describe the selection at Just Pots? It's like if there was this huge international convention for pots, and they all just decided to stay. Because at Just Pots, you can choose from over 40,000 pots from around the world. Every shape, size, color, and style you can imagine, all at great prices. Just Pots. A whole lot of pots in one convenient spot. Open every day on Redland Road, a quarter mile south of 1604, or at justpots.com.
Listen to this station anytime, anywhere on Odyssey. Odyssey is your new audio home for all the music, news, sports, and podcasts that matter to you. Odyssey. That's A-U-D-A-C-Y.
The Festival of Flowers returns for its 23rd year, Saturday, June 3rd at the San Antonio Shrine Auditorium. It's a full day of learning about gardening and landscape care from the experts, co-hosted by San Antonio Water System. And you can pick up a free water saver plant from Saws while supplies last. Shop the Festival of Flowers Indoor Garden Mall for plants, landscape materials, fertilizers, and garden accessories. Stop by the Herb Cooking Kitchen for some delicious treats. Enjoy seminars and the Organic Roundtable and a Learn to Garden Zone just for kids. Plus, swap your plants at the Citywide Plant Exchange. It's all happening at the Festival of Flowers. Admission is $8. Kids under 10 are free, plus lots of free parking. The 23rd Festival of Flowers, co-hosted by San Antonio Water System, Saturday, June 3rd from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the San Antonio Shrine Auditorium, exit Stone Oak Parkway. Festival of Flowers.
Hey, it's Trey Ware here for Diamond Decks of San Antonio, Diamond Decks TX. Hey, we can stay outside most of the year down here, right? We can enjoy it during the summer months and stay nice and cool outside with a Diamond Deck, or we can do it during the winter, enjoying a nice hot cup of coffee or whatever your beverage of choice is. They do custom decks and composite decks and composite decks with Trex and TimberTech. They do kitchens and patios and pergolas and arbors. They do patio covers and Renaissance patio products. They do room enclosures and screen enclosures. Closures and stamp concrete and so much more at Diamond Decks, all with the professionalism that you're looking for. We like to be outside in this part of the country. It's called outdoor living, but you like to be comfortable and have a beautiful space that adds to the value of your home, right? Well, log on to the website right now, DiamondDecksTX.com, because seeing truly is believing. And then contact Diamond Decks for a free in-home evaluation. That's DiamondDecksTX.com.
Whether it's at your house or ours, Magnolia Pancake House takes care of all your catering needs. From our famous pancakes made on site to our online ordering for a quick pickup, we can customize your order to exactly what you need. You'll find us at MagnoliaPancakeHouse.com.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening on this beautiful weekend, Memorial Day weekend. It just did get a lot prettier than what the weather's going to be out there today. Going to get a little warm this afternoon, so probably want to do your heavier work and your hole digging this morning and things, but sure hope you're planning to get outside. And remind you that if you've got a landscape project going on, shrubs, trees, ground covers, all that stuff is free from sales tax this weekend only, along with mulches, compost, potting soils, all that sort of thing. And anytime you can save some money on it, it might be a good time to kind of stock up on things. Let's talk to Chris. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Bob. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
I got four questions.
Okay.
One is I was given a candlestick.
Empress candlestick, yes.
The leaves fold up at night, open up in the morning.
Right.
When do they start blooming?
When it gets hot. Typically, it's around the 1st of July when they really come into full bloom. It depends on the year, but midsummer, then they go all the way up until freezing weather. They make a lot of seed. Be sure that you collect some of the seed because you know, 9 years out of 10, they will freeze and die in the winter months. They are an annual cassia, C-A-S-S-I-A is the genus on that, but they sure grow easily from seed. And you're looking at a plant, it's probably going to get 6 or 8 feet tall, but really pretty plant, loves the sun, very few problems with Empress Candlestick.
Okay, because mine's in a, they gave it to me in a pot, and the pot's like 14 inches by 12 inches in diameter. So should I put it in a bigger pot? It's like 6 foot tall right now.
Yeah, I'd probably leave it in that size or plant it in the ground. If you have a place to plant it, they're easier to maintain in the ground. But you're not going to accomplish much putting it into a pot that you can't move around because it'll be too heavy. But as long as you can keep it watered, you're fine in a pot or in the ground either way.
Okay. All right, next one is ghost peppers. I've had a whole bunch of peppers, and my ghost peppers, they're in a five-gallon bucket. There's three of them. And I water them every 2 to 3 days, and all of a sudden they started turning yellow on me and drooping and like they're dead. And all my other peppers are going good except for my ghost peppers.
How often are you fertilizing and what are you using?
Hash to grow plants, and then also use the fertilizer, Nature's Creation.
Okay. I would probably, I'd cut down on the dry fertilizer. And on your watering, be certain that when you water, you really, really flutter. These are in pots. They're not in the ground. They're in pots.
In 5 gallon buckets.
Okay. It sounds
to me.
I water
all of them like that.
Yeah. I would, of course, in watering, water very, very thoroughly, but let them get a little drier. It's unusual that the ghost peppers would be the only ones affected. But what you're describing is very typical where the plants just have stayed too waterlogged. Water doesn't hurt anything, but when water drives the oxygen out of the soil, that's when your roots suffer, and it may be the ghost peppers are just a little bit more susceptible to that problem. I would I'd let them get good and dry between waterings. I'd probably use a little Super Thrive, maybe a little Garrett juice. You might even give a little foliar spray. And if anything will bring them back, that will. Just remember there's no such thing as too much water, but there really is too often. And it sounds to me like they've just at some point they've stayed a little too wet, which, like I say, it's not the water. It's driving all the oxygen out of the soil that's caused the problem.
Okay. All right, and the third question is worms. On my front patio, my driveway, they look like earthworms are all the same size, but every morning there's earthworm or some type of worm on my patio and driveway.
And they're segmented, just the regular kind of fleshy.
They look like
color.
It, but they're really sticky. They're really sticky. When you touch them, they stick onto you. But, you know, but they're on my driveway and patio every morning.
They probably, it's the result of the rains. It literally is just, they probably are earthworms that have just simply been forced up out of the ground because the ground is so wet. And yes, they cover themselves with kind of a mucus material. I just, you know, would shovel them up as best you can, throw them back out in the yard. But they, a lot of them just somehow commit suicide. They just come up and get on the driveway, get on the porch. And it's the one of the downsides of the good rains that we've had recently.
I mean, because they're all the same size, about 1.25 inches long. They're all the same size. That's what gets me. They're all the same size.
It probably just, in effect, a hatching of them. They do make, you know, earthworms do lay eggs, and this is the time of year they start reproducing. So I think it's weather-related.
Okay. Alrighty, and the fourth question is I have a Mount Laurel that has three branches at the bottom. I know it's planted too deep. How deep do I go to get that out? Because I just heard y'all about the Mount Laurels, and I said, one of three branches.
Yeah, just pull the soil back away to where you see the major roots flaring out from the base. You don't, you know, you're not excavating it. You're basically, what you want to have is air circulation anything above the point where your major roots come out, you want good air circulating around the trunk of the plant. So hopefully you won't have to pull too much away, and you can probably just leave sort of a saucer-like depression around the plant, and it'll do just fine. So nothing real major. Just get down to where the trunks, and this goes for all trees, but especially mountain laurels would be a good example of a tree that's going to suffer if it stays too deep. So just use whatever simple tool you can. One of the arborists I know uses old hay hooks and things like that to pull the soil back away.
Okay. All right. I appreciate it, sir. You have a good holiday with
you. You do the same. Good questions, and I appreciate the call, Chris. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.